illness. We'll check in with our US correspondent for the latest from there. But first, the government's attempts to tackle the number of young people who are not in employment, education or training. The NEETs. That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. Ministers say young people could lose access to some of their benefits if they don't engage with government help to get them into work. It will provide support to around 900,000 on universal credit, with posts in hospitality, construction and the care sector being made available. But the education campaigner Madeleine Holt has been telling LBC deprivation also needs to be addressed.
There is, you know, a patchwork coming together, which I think suggests there's a correlation, and I'm not the only one saying it, between children who are growing up in poverty, who are doing really badly in terms of the conventional qualifications. And King's Trust research said there's a real problem with low confidence amongst children and students who then become NEETs.
And there'll be more on this over the next hour with Nick Abbott here on LBC. It's expected the leader of the Conservatives will call on the government to speed up the creation of a national grooming gangs inquiry. Kemi Badenoch is due to hold a news conference on the issue tomorrow. It's believed she'll release a new draft terms of reference drawn up with the help of some survivors. The authorities in Ukraine say at least four people have died following combined Russian attacks overnight involving missiles and drones. The claims come as Russia welcomes a new national security plan from the US, which talks about friendlier ties with the Kremlin. Volodymyr Zelensky is due to meet with Sir Keir Starmer and other world leaders in London tomorrow, but the defence analyst, Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Crawford, has been telling LBC that could still be a fool's errand.
There's no circumstances under which currently the Zelensky administration in Kiev is able to surrender land which has been illegally occupied by Russia. So we're at a stalemate, and this could go on for many, many months and years to come.
The Israeli Prime Minister says Donald Trump's peace plan for Gaza could move into its second phase imminently. Benjamin Netanyahu is now predicting the disarming of Hamas and the demilitarization of Gaza could begin later this month. And in sport, Lando Norris is Britain's 11th Formula One world champion after finishing third at the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. Max Verstappen won the season-ending race but still couldn't defend his title successfully. LBC weather, dry with clear spells for much of the UK overnight and feeling mild. Heavy showers containing some hail and thunder will affect the southwest during the early hours of tomorrow morning. We'll see a low of around 5 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. Young people are about to be pushed into work whether they like it or not. Those that are NEETs, that is not that their hair is smart and has a parting, it's that those who are not in employment, education or training and have not been so for 18 months are going to be offered a position, and if they don't take it, they have their benefits removed. That is the plan. Young people are going to be stripped of their rights to claim benefits if they refuse a taxpayer-funded job after 18 months without a job. That's Pat McFadden saying that. He is the Work and Pensions Secretary. Apparently one in eight of 16 to 24-year-olds are so-called NEETs, not in employment, education or training. McFadden said they'd need a good reason to decline a job if it were offered to them. Let's talk about this with Aisha Malik-Smith. Aisha Malik-Smith is a trade union organiser and Labour councillor for Lewisham. Good evening, Aisha.
Good evening, Nick. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time. What do you make of this plan?
Firstly, I think it's really important that we are providing more support for young workers. In this economy, we know that young workers are disproportionately in some of the lowest paid sectors and suffer from some of the poorest working conditions. So really, I think the government must engage with trade unions. Of course, we represent millions of workers already in these sectors. And I would also say that sanctions really aren't and shouldn't be part of the solution. I believe they're quite a blunt tool that do more harm than good. Now, in terms of the industries that the government is proposing to support young people in to work in, we're looking at construction, hospitality and care. Now, these are industries already marked by insecure jobs, low pay and poor working conditions. So I think we really need to see better pay in these sectors. But we should also acknowledge that the government has acted to increase the minimum wage above inflation for the past 2 years, which has benefited some of the lowest paid workers, who are, of course, the backbone of our economy. But
so, yes, I have a question, but if you had anything more to say, please go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, in reality, we know that poor job security, pay and conditions is often what drives poor mental health. If you're working long hours for low pay and you're still struggling to pay the bills, of course you're going to be struggling, and it's no wonder that there's so much unhappiness and anxiety among society. It's really being compounded by this sense of alienation and isolation that we're all feeling after recovering from the pandemic, that's driven by a sort of sense of disconnect and a sense of powerlessness in the workplace.
Yes, low pay is a continuing problem. As a trade unionist, are you concerned, though, that these people who would accept a position at minimum wage, paid for by the government, would actually have the effect of pushing down wages for other workers in those sectors?
I can't see that being the case, but I believe the best solution to job insecurity and low pay is collective bargaining. Workers can reclaim their power at work by getting together collectively in a union to negotiate better conditions. Now, what that looks like in practice is that if you can get over 50% of your colleagues in your team, in your workplace, to join a union, you can demand your employer recognises that union and consults with you collectively around pay and employment policies. In many cases, we're seeing this drive up working conditions, more flexible working, better sick pay, and those are the things that really support people in work.
Yes, these are the benefits. Hang on a minute. These are the benefits of being in a trade union. Yes, complete agreement from me there, though. But if we have 350,000, well, actually 946,000 young people who are NEET at the moment, not in education, employment or training, and the government's position is that they want to create 350,000 training or work experience placements, then it does rather suggest that what it looks a bit like, if you squinted, forced labour at minimum wage, which is bound to undercut the position of the people who are already in those sectors, surely.
Well, we shouldn't be looking to be undercutting workers by including more people in the labour market and encouraging more people in the labour market. But what enables people to be in work is decent working conditions. If you're off sick with a long-term chronic health condition, you're not going to be able to afford to get sick if your employer doesn't provide sick pay and you're forced to rely on statutory sick pay, which is around 120 quid a week. No one can pay their bills on that.
Right. Okay. But on the topic at hand, though, these young people who are going to be stripped of their rights, apparently, their rights to claim benefits if they refuse a taxpayer-funded job, do you think that companies would appreciate young staff who are only there under duress?
I don't think we should be pushing people under duress into the workforce. I think our welfare system should be compassionate. And I would disagree with the government's positioning around forcing sanctions upon people to coerce them into work.
Is it a form of tough love, though? Because, you know, if you have been out of work as a young person for 18 months, it is true, isn't it, that the longer you're out of work, the harder it is to get into work.
I think we also need to be talking a bit about industrial strategy and how we ensure these jobs are decent jobs rather than jobs that aren't contributing to society. And everyone knows when they feel like they have a job that doesn't bring value to the economy, that doesn't bring value to our society. Now, these sectors they are talking about are some of our key sectors that are some of the most practical sectors where everyone can see the benefits of having more people in employment there.
Yeah, one is the hospitality sector, isn't it? I mean, Lewis Goodall, our own Lewis Goodall, he had the Work and Pensions Secretary, Pat McFadden, on his show today on LBC. He pointed out that the hospitality sector, which is one of the key sectors that the government has identified, is actually losing jobs. They're shedding jobs at the moment. So how would a sector that is losing jobs find new ones that have value that you are describing for a young person for only 6 months? That's what this scheme allows for.
I think you're right to pick up on some of the issues around the hospitality sector. We know they've been facing issues from energy bills, and we are seeing this increase in our economy of corporate profiteering, with the big energy companies making millions in profits and paying out dividends to their shareholders at the expense of those of us who pay bills, whether we're normal residents or whether we're small hospitality businesses, bars, that aren't able to keep the energy running to make their venues viable. Now, that's a sort of slightly separate issue in terms of how we boost the hospitality industry meaningfully, but it can't be a race to the bottom around workers' rights, around decent working conditions. And it also can't be using such a blunt instrument as sanctions to coerce people into the workplace, when actually the current contemporary issues in work are not very supportive of people with all sorts of mental health conditions, long-term physical illnesses, and anything that may be covered under the Equality Act as a disability.
Yeah, we're going to talk on this show about the alarming rise in those young people with mental health conditions a little later on. What about the work ethic of British youth? They do have quite a poor reputation. You've probably heard tales from employers exasperated by young people's attitude to work. How will employers be persuaded to join this scheme and bring on those people who many of whom won't really want to be there?
I think people have a bad attitude to work, not just young people in general, when they can't see the fruits of their labour. They can't enjoy it. It's like being able to smell the honey on the end of your elbow but not able to taste it. So I feel that a lot of young workers in new employment aren't seeing the fruits of their labour, and the best way for them to do so and for employers to do so is by working with trade unions to improve those working conditions, so that those in the workplace, employees, feel they have more autonomy, more power over what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, and better able to shape their work in the way that suits them. Often we see middle management or senior management that have never done the job on the shop floor in their lives and can be quite out of touch with what is the reality of running the business. So we need more power for those frontline workers in their jobs.
I wonder if this, I mean, I've alluded to it before, but I'll make the point again. I wonder if this actually would have the opposite effect, because the placements are fully funded. The government is going to give these companies the money to put these young people in a position for 6 months. I mean, you know, a bad business person might just employ a young person as free labour for the short term with little intention of making the position permanent.
I mean, you're quite right to raise that. I'd be very concerned about that. And I think the devil will be in the detail in terms of how they plan to do this. Of course, I'll be looking more into it over the coming week, as I'm sure all employers and trade unions will be doing, in what the detail of the government is proposing. But I really feel that we've seen things like food prices going up 38% in 5 years, Tesco's operating profits, to give one example, up 72%. There's being a huge transfer of wealth and power in this country to the richest. And every pound, every penny that a multinational corporation is squeezing out in profits or paying out in dividends to shareholders, in my opinion, is a pound pinched from the pockets of hardworking people. And too often, this money leaves our high streets for tax haven. So we do really need to have a much broader conversation in this country about the nature of work, about why people are out of work. That includes talking about the mental health conditions, the disabilities, the causes of health inequality in this country, whether that's poor quality housing. But also, I believe that a really fundamental issue for people remaining in work is the lack of good work and the lack of decent jobs.
And are you concerned?
Well.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but are you concerned as a trade unionist of the tsunami of change that is barreling towards us, that is artificial intelligence? AI is developing at an exponential speed. I mean, is it possible that this scheme, setting young people into work, are going to be putting them in jobs that will shortly not exist?
I think artificial intelligence and automation is something we always are right to be concerned about and should be looking to ensure this government is actually getting a grip on the reality of what it's bringing, because the nature of our society has changed so much. I mean, I'm in my mid-20s. I grew up on VHS tapes and five channels on the telly, but by the time I was going through adolescence, it was the dawn of the smartphone, and we are really, I think, quite far behind looking at what new technological advancements are doing to us as people, as humans, in terms of the short-term attention that we're getting from our phones and from the algorithms. So it's not just artificial intelligence that concerns me, but certainly in terms of how it affects the labour market and people in the workplace, we do need to keep an eye on it. And I'm worried that with the many billions of pounds at stake in this, these new technologies, it's going to be really important for ordinary people to make their voices heard to government, because there are significantly wealthy interests at play here.
Yes, and just finally, employers do not pay employers' national insurance on staff under 21, apparently. That's a big inducement for an employer. So why do you think that employers appear not to have taken advantage of that with a million 16 to 21-year-olds unemployed?
I mean, I couldn't really say why they're not taking advantage of that inducement, but I would say, returning to one of your previous points, I think, about how potentially this is going to flood the labour market with younger people undercutting wages on the basis of it being a six-month period. These workers are not going to have time to get embedded in their workplaces, not going to have time to potentially understand the different power dynamics at play, but also get involved in their unions. And I would be concerned on that front as well, that this is very much a short-term fix. It may well be the catalyst to getting more people into work, but with I have so many concerns about the use of sanctions, about the short-term nature of this, and about the already poor conditions in the sectors that they're looking at.
Very good to talk to you, Aisha. I really appreciate your time. Thanks for that. Aisha Malik-Smith, trade union organiser and Labour councillor for Lewisham. So what do you make of this idea? I mean, the government surely has to do something in order to try to persuade or make it more accessible for young people to get into either work or education or training. And is it tough love to say that young people will be stripped of their right to claim benefits if they refuse a taxpayer-funded job if they've been without a job for 18 months? Or is that unreasonable? And what about the positions that they're actually going to be holding? I mean, the construction industry is a pretty tough business. The care industry is a very difficult sector to be involved in, indeed. I mean, it's a very particular set of skills, social care, and usually requires or certainly benefits from a desire to do that job. What is a difficult and sometimes traumatic job? Is it appropriate to have somebody who might be doing so begrudgingly to do that work? And have you any experience of work placements? I certainly do, and they didn't really amount to much. 0345 6060 973, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
This is LBC.
At ulizprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulizprosperity.com.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
The Big Tasty is back at McDonald's, but now it's a double. It's the beefiest Big Tasty of all time ever. Oh, got a bit intense there. The new Double Big Tasty, now at McDonald's. Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary, subject to availability.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
There are apparently 946,000 young people who were NEET, N-E-E-T, that is not in education, employment or training. Just shy of a million in the 3 months to September. That is about 13% of all young people aged 16 to 24. Now, that is certainly something that the government has to address, because if you go too long as a young person without a job, it becomes increasingly difficult to get into work. I wonder if you think that this is a good use of public money, because they're going to be offering people of that age, 16 to 24, six-month placements in either a work sector as in education or training, which is going to be fully subsidised by the taxpayer. Fully subsidised for 25 hours a week, paid at the legal minimum wage. They're going to be, the government has put up £820 million, that's what was announced in the budget, and that money will be allocated until 2029. Their expectations are low to begin with. Well, it looks as though they're low. The government plans to create 350,000 training and work experience placements, and say that they expect more than 1,000 young people to start a job in the first 6 months of the scheme. Now, those 350,000 placements are not going to be coming on all at the same time, but 1,000 seems like a low number. Perhaps they are managing our expectations. But what do you make of this? Particularly the idea that young people will be stripped of their right to claim benefits if they refuse to go along with this. Rochester, Alison.
Hello, Nick.
Alison.
Hi. Yeah, I think everyone on benefits, on unemployment benefits, should work to receive their benefits, unless they've got a really good health reason. And then sometimes people are carers, but they're receiving unemployment benefits with their carers, then I think the state should help with that. But yeah, definitely, I think it's a good thing. I think it'll give them confidence. It'll make them more employable. And I think some people need a nudge. And if the families aren't nudging them hard enough, then the state needs to do it.
Yes, I mean, I wonder how the companies who are going to be involved in this will actually be viewing this, as whether it's perhaps just a box-ticking exercise, whether they feel, well, we'll get some young person in for 6 months, they will be free to us, essentially, that company won't be paying for their wages. And by that method, they'll, it's like, well, it's not slave labour exactly, but it's sort of forced labour, really, under menaces. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, I think as you touched on, it's beneficial for the companies if they're getting someone whose wages are being paid for by the state. Then, yeah, I mean, some of them might not like it. They might not want someone who's not keen to work. But then some of them, you know, you've got Timpsons that likes to take on ex-prisoners. You know, you have companies that perhaps are keen to take on young people and perhaps are well-placed to train them up, such as the hospitality industry, which traditionally takes on young people and trains them up. So, I don't know, I guess some will like it and some might not, but I think that it's beneficial for them.
Yes, perhaps. All right, good talking to you, Alison. Thanks for that. This text says, it is a more expensive benefit and there is anecdotal evidence to justify periodic investigation for fringe cases. I'm not quite sure what that means. Haringey. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Nick. First time I've called you. Actually, I've spoken on other shows. First time
Welcome
calling
along.
To the show. Nice to speak to you, Nick, and you are very funny, by the way.
Well, not on Sundays, I'm not.
This is not going to be easy and straightforward, because I've worked with people in who've been sent along by under duress from the benefits agency. You know, the benefits are going to be sanctioned if they don't do the job.
Oh, yeah.
And they have been a major pain in the bum.
Can you tell me what kind of business you were in?
It was promotions and stuff like that, but, you know, it doesn't really matter. I was an agency temp for a long time.
Right.
And I've done my CV is a real patchwork quilt of, you know, all sorts of different bits and pieces.
So in what way were they a pain?
I got pushed by one of them. I was supposed to be supervising someone. I got shoved by one of them. Do you remember the, at the UK Olympics, there were a whole load of people who were supposed to turn up and show people where to go and all those stewards.
Oh, they had to bring the army in.
They didn't even show up. They said yes because they were under duress from the benefits agency, but come the day, they weren't there.
I went a couple of times. Yeah, well, I went a couple of times, and I do know that the people who didn't appear for whatever reason were replaced by the army. I do remember that. Yeah.
So it's not going to be straightforward. Try and force people when they really don't want to go. Now throw in mental health issues and physical health issues, and the odd person here and there who can't even regulate themselves. And see how it goes. And, you know, this is not going to be straightforward.
And I wonder if it's best to bite the bullet now and do as much as is possible for those young people, because their sort of mindset will not improve the longer they are out of work.
Well, it's difficult for me to comment on them because I love working. I'm a workaholic by nature. Somebody had to point out to me I was doing 19-hour days.
Wow.
And it hadn't even occurred to me.
19 hours?
Nick, I'm such a workaholic. I resent having to stop to eat. I resent having to stop to sleep. If I could work 24/7, 365 days of the year, I would. 366 days of the year, if I could. You know, it's hard for me to get into the mindset of some of those people. But what I can tell you is that stress can knock people out. I've spoken on Vanessa's show about that one.
Oh, yeah.
And I've gone into some detail, and I won't go into the same detail here because I don't think we've got the time. But it can physically knock people out. It's not fight or flight. It's fight, flight, or freeze, which is why Prince Harry said he couldn't get out of bed. And there's a good reason for it. It's an old survival mechanism. Too much stress for too long. And some people will just plain conk out.
Yeah, and that's not what you want at work, particularly in something like construction or the care sector. Good talking to you, Steve. Thanks for that. Lucy says, this is a complete waste of time and money. The snowflake youth of today, her spelling, youth, have no interest in work, only being glued to their mobile phones. If challenged, they claim mental health issues. What a mess, says Lucy. Well, that is the image that some people have of young people. And I've had employers call up when this kind of topic comes up, as it has done over the past, and they will tell me about how dreadful their experience of young workers is. Maybe it was ever thus. People are just expressing that opinion more, whether they feel, I suppose with social media and so on, it's easier to get the message out. But were young people ever that keen on working? And do you think that it is a positive thing rather than a negative? It's very easy to paint it as a negative that young people will be stripped of their right to claim benefits if they refuse a taxpayer-funded job that they might not want to do. That is after 18 months without a job. But, I mean, it's easy to say that that's negative, that this will be forced labour, that they won't be a positive employee, they won't have, a positive frame of mind at their work. But if they're just left to sort of wither on the vine, then that benefits neither them nor society at large, really, because the more you earn, the less you are likely to have health problems and the less you are likely to depend on state benefits. That's undeniable. So perhaps ripping the plaster off at an early age is precisely what should happen. It's, and if that's true, then it's kind of odd that it hasn't happened already. Chancellor Rachel Reeves, by the way, previously announced that the government would be funding a scheme to make apprenticeship training for under 25s at small and medium businesses completely free. It's a separate idea. It's not policy, I don't think, but it's a separate idea. But the one that we're talking about at the moment is that 16 to 24-year-olds, 350,000 training and work experience placements will be offered to them, and they will lose their benefits if they don't accept at least one of them. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. After the break, more of your calls on this. We're going to hear from crime and policing expert Danny Shaw about an alleged pepper spray attack at Heathrow Airport earlier today that you might have heard about. It's 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Another government announcement is due to be made on tackling youth unemployment. Sir Keir Starmer will detail plans tomorrow on spending £725 million on getting 50,000 younger people into newly created apprenticeships. It's expected the leader of the Conservatives will use a news conference on Monday to demand the government speeds up the creation of a national grooming gangs inquiry. It's believed Kemi Badenoch will also release a new draft terms of reference for the investigation. And a 19-year-old man's being arrested after the death of two people following a collision involving three cars in Lincolnshire. It happened near Boston on Saturday evening. LBC weather, dry with clear spells for much of the UK overnight. Heavy showers, including hail and thunder, though, will affect the southwest during the early hours. Mild with a low of 5 degrees.
This is LBC.
For the nappies, peekaboos and tea parties. Mess, tantrums and sleepless nights. All those yo-yos, action figures and shinies. Lifts to mates, lifts to parties, lifts everywhere. For each and every one of those teenage years. Let's be honest, you probably owe your parents one. So tell them about pension credit. It could boost their pension income by an average of over £4,000 a year. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
Protect your pets over this festive period. Visit petsinapickle.co.uk and enjoy Christmas covered.
Think about cheese. Make your thoughts cheesier. Now add 100% chicken breast fillet, chipotle sauce and a mega cheese melt. And it's giving the new cheesy chicken stack at McDonald's. Did we mention it's cheesy?
Cheese.
Available until the 4th of Jan 2026 from 11am. Price and participation may vary. Subject to availability.
At Laithwaite, we go to great lengths to bring you great wine. We go far and wide. Searching high, and we mean really high, and low. And we mean stored deep underground in a cave low. Off the shelf? We don't go there. Off the beaten track, we certainly go there. And the best bit is, we even come to you. Order now at laithwaites.co.uk. Laithwaites. We stop at nothing to bring you great wine.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
More of your calls on this idea by the government to offer 350,000 places over the next few years to 18 to 21-year-olds who are on universal credit and have been looking for work for 18 months. So helping them out in that regard, but also with the stick of, I mean, if that's the carrot, then the stick is that if they don't accept one of the jobs that's offered to them, then they will lose their benefits. 0345 6060 973. More of your thoughts on that to come. But you will have heard about this incident at Heathrow. A man arrested on suspicion of assault after people were allegedly attacked with a form of pepper spray in a multi-storey car park at that airport. Let's talk about this with Danny Shaw, who joins us on the line now. Hello, Danny.
Good evening, Nick. Hi.
Very good to talk to you. Thanks for your time. Pepper spray. I didn't think you could get that in this country. Is it easy to find pepper spray here?
Well, it's illegal to have a pepper spray, and it's certainly illegal to use it. pepper spray is used, a form of pepper spray are used by the police, a parva spray. It's synthetic pepper substance. Pepper sprays, normally the chemical used is the one found in chili peppers. It's called capsaicin, and it's got high concentrations of that kind of pepper, and it causes pain, burning sensation, can cause people to tear up, breathing problems, rashes. Normally the sort of symptoms sort of disappear within 30 minutes to an hour or so. Sometimes it can be more severe and can lead to people having to be taken to hospital. But, you know, these are weapons, essentially, that are banned under the Firearms Act 1968. And so, you know, if anyone's found to have used it, you know, some serious consequences will follow. I mean, quite unusual, I would say, Nick, to, you know, to hear of an incident involving pepper spray. Certainly this one sounds like it was quite frightening, actually, at Heathrow this morning.
Yes, it's unusual to hear of somebody using pepper spray in this country, but it's doubly unusual to hear about anything of the kind at an airport. I mean, you'd think of all the places in the country that you wouldn't want to brandish an illegal weapon, it would be an airport.
Yeah, because airports are, you know, full of armed cops, and that's essentially what happened. For those of you who haven't been following it, police were alerted just after 10 past 8 this morning. They went to Terminal 3, multi-storey car park, very busy. You know, this is, you know, a hub for flights. And on a weekend, you know, even though it's a Sunday morning, still a lot of people coming and going there. And what they are now saying that believe has happened is that a group of people were trying to rob a woman of her suitcase, group of four men trying to rob a woman of her suitcase at the multi-storey car park, and they sprayed a substance believed to be pepper spray in her direction. Now, that spray has caught not just her, it would seem, but a lot of other people. Around 21 people were treated at the scene. Five people were taken to hospital with their injuries. Their injuries not life-changing or life-threatening. And one of those who was treated was a three-year-old girl. Hmm. Witnesses have said, you know, it was a scene sort of from a movie, because once police were called, armed officers, up and down the spiral staircase at that multi-storey car park, teaming around, cars told not to go anywhere, trains halted for a bit, sort of chaos at the stations around there, and gridlock as well, people trying to get to the airport. You can just imagine, because, you know, initially I think the fear was that this was some kind of terrorist incident. One witness said he saw young men dressed in black darting through the crowd, and when they left, people started coughing, and this witness himself felt a sort of burning sensation at the back of his throat, and then suddenly 10 to 20 armed officers arrived.
Yes, I mean, you know, in retrospect, it's easy to say that maybe the police overreacted. I mean, the whole airport was affected. Roads, gridlock, like you said, trains cancelled, buses delayed by 3 hours for some people. I mean, there's about 260,000 people go through Heathrow on an average Sunday, and this incident only affected about 20 people in one car park. Was it enough to essentially shut down the airport?
Well, police don't know what they're dealing with initially. That's the concern. It's very easy for us sitting here at 10:30 in the evening, you know, 14 hours later, to be able to say, oh, well, this was just a robbery or an attempted robbery with a group of people and a woman with a suitcase. But, you know, initially, I imagine police got some reports of pepper spray being discharged, as we've said, very unusual incident. Four men running off in all directions, chaos, panic. And obviously the fear is, you know, there's some sort of armed gang potentially on the loose, or some terrorists, you know, have launched an attack. So, you know, you can understand why they have to err on the side of caution. So, I'm not sure it was an overreaction. You know, I don't think that would be a fair assessment, you know, because police just don't know what they're dealing with at that moment. That's the issue. And particularly with an airport, it is always felt to be a sort of a potential target, those fears would have escalated.
Have you heard of this sort of thing happen before? Because it hadn't occurred to me that, you know, you hear about people having their phones snatched or their bags taken while they're in the pub. But people who arrive at the airport have got a lot of presumably expensive stuff on them. You know, they'll have their headphones and their phones and their laptops and, you know, all that, and jewellery and all that stuff, and money and their credit cards and so on. So they probably don't go out of the house with that much of value on them at any other time other than to go to the airport. Mm. Are you aware of a sort of a crime centred crimes like this centred around airports before?
I haven't heard of a suitcase being, you know, the target of a robbery. I mean, obviously, I think bag snatches even in the vicinity of airports is not unheard of. But a suitcase is interesting. Now, you know, the question I would ask is, was this a sort of random, opportunistic attack by a gang of thieves who decided to, you know, carry out a robbery at an airport knowing that there were people coming off planes or going onto planes with valuables in the suitcase? Or is it something where they specifically knew this woman is carrying some valuable items in her suitcase? Were they valuable items or were they illegal items? You know, I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I have no intelligence, but, you know, but you begin to wonder whether, you know, there was something that, you know, in that suitcase that shouldn't have been there, or did they just know that actually she had jewelry or she had cash or other items there? I mean, it would seem to me that if you're four people working together on this, you're going to have a pretty good idea that there's something valuable in that suitcase. Otherwise, why take the risk with all those cameras, with all the armed cops, you know, just a few yards away?
It seems extraordinary that anybody thought that a small bag, you could sort of put up your jacket and wander out undetected. But a suitcase, presumably, I mean, they're not going to wheel it out on its own. They're going to put it in a vehicle of some sort.
Presumably,
and there can't be many places in the country that have more cameras pointed at the people there than Heathrow Airport.
Yeah, it feels like that this was something that was planned and the target was understood to be of something of value. There were also the initial reports that Scotland Yard put out was that this was an altercation involving two groups that it escalated. So you then think, well, were the victims, was it just a woman by herself, or was she with other people who were known to the offenders, or were they just, you know, was it just a robbery and the woman and perhaps with others was resisting it? So there are some unknown questions around this. And hopefully we will get some more answers in the days to come. There is a suspect in custody at the moment, a 31-year-old man, arrested on suspicion of assault. You know, we will see what happens to him. He's being questioned at the moment, and we will see whether any charges are brought against him. And then we may get some details at court if that does indeed go to court of what actually took place. But it's certainly one to keep an eye on. No wider risk. That's the good news. Airport's back to normal and has been back to normal for some hours. No wider risk to any other members of the public, but certainly intriguing.
Certainly is. Thanks for your time, Danny. That's Danny Shaw, the crime and policing expert, Danny Shaw. This is LBC. I'm Nick Abbott. We were talking about this plan by the government to offer 16 to 24-year-olds on universal credit, who have been looking for work for 18 months, or perhaps they haven't been looking for work for 18 months, but they've been without a job. They will create, the government, 350,000 training and work experience placements for those people, those young people who are on benefits and have been out of work or training for 18 months. The method of impelling them to take those positions as they're offered is to strip them of their right to claim benefits if they refuse. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. Paisley, William.
Hiya.
William.
Hiya, I'm just wanting to say, I think it's quite dangerous to force people into maybe jobs they've not got experience in, because I was out of work for about 7 months there, and then I started a delivery job, and I've ended up being in a crash and that, because I was doing deliveries on bikes, and I got into a crash, and I put my back now, so I'm going to be out of work even longer.
Hmm. So what training would you have liked to have had?
I was only gave, like, 20 minutes training on, like, this electric bike thing, where it's got, like, a big bookshelf in the back to do deliveries.
Right.
So I only had, like, 2 days training.
And you'd never ridden a bike?
I've ridden a bike when I was a wee guy, but this was, like, going... It would go, like, 16 miles an hour, and it had, like, a big massive bookshelf in the back to describe it, to keep parcels in. It was, and you'd do like 100 stops a day.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like, that's quite a graft, and I've been working since I was 15, but I've not done a physical job in 5 or 6 years, so I think it's easy enough if you're like a 40-year-old or 50-year-old man sitting as a civil servant in London, like, oh, this is a brilliant idea. But if the practical realities of it, if you've got people maybe having done these kinds of jobs before, you're going to end up with people blocking up the NHS and people written off with lifelong injuries who will become dependent for their whole life. So maybe they shouldn't just rush people into jobs. It should be a bit more planned than just forcing people, in my opinion.
All right, good to talk to you, William. Thanks for that. Yes, I wonder if that is particularly appropriate for the construction industry, because that's one of the sectors that the government is looking at offering positions in. And that's a dangerous business, construction. The placements will only be for 6 months. Now, that implies to me that a construction business wouldn't start the expensive process of training somebody in a trade because they're only going to be there for 6 months. So is that then just free basic labouring? And I don't know, but I would imagine that one of the most dangerous jobs to do on a building site is basic labouring. 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Would she lie to you? Part one.
As part of cutting the debt and the borrowing, I was really upfront. I wanted to increase the size of the headroom against my fiscal rules.
Would she lie to you? Part two.
We now read that she's misled us about being the under 14 British girls chess champion. Is this checkmate for the Chancellor?
I'm absolutely thrilled that she's finally being called out on this chess thing.
The world, according to Rachel Reeves, hits a collision course next week as she faces a post-budget showdown in front of a panel of MPs. They think it's all OBR for the Chancellor. It could be now.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
There's an old Thai saying that roughly translates as, the family who takes the internet on holiday can locate a less crowded beach. Particularly handy, my friend, if it's peak mating season for nippy little crabs. Back the internet with an eSIM from Aerolo. That's A-I-R-A-L-O.
Trying to brighten with the besties. Immaculate vibes, as always. But I bet my ice skating is going to be pure chaos.
Oh, Em, you better hold my hand. Oh, I'm going up.
No, styled it out. I've got this.
Last one to the other side buys the hot chocolate.
Back on the train. Only fell twice.
Low-key legend.
We have to do this every year.
Download the Southern Railway app to book tickets and save a third off group travel and off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story.
At Fixident, we believe that wearing dentures doesn't have to define you. So with Fixident Ultimate 3-in-1 Denture Adhesive Cream, you get triple benefits in one. All-day comfort, a built-in food barrier, and a confidently strong hold to help you get a grip on the important things in life, like winning the Battle of the Baguette, making peace with the peanuts, and conquering that shiny, crisp Cox's Pippin. Try Fixident Ultimate 3-in-1 Denture Adhesive Cream for all-day, everyday confidence. Fixident. Life with more bite.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We're talking about the government plan to offer six-month roles, which will be fully subsidised by the taxpayer for 25 hours a week paid at the legal minimum wage for 16 to 24-year-olds who are not in education, employment or training and have not been so for 18 months. If they don't take the position and they are absent a good excuse, then they're going to have their benefits taken away from them. What do you make of that? Southampton. Hello, Paul.
Hello, Nick. Good evening.
Paul.
I just think there's a culture in this country of the world owes me a living. There's too many people on benefits, too many snowflakes, and the woke culture. They've got this mental illness, they're on drugs, they're on they're alcoholics, they've got sore backs. I've employed hundreds of people in my lifetime, and I can tell you now, I've seen it firsthand what some of these people do, and I know associates who are claiming thousands of pounds of benefits every month, and there's nothing wrong with them whatsoever. Now, in Europe, you have a six-month period where if you, after those 6 months, if you don't have a job, you lose your benefits, full stop. We are too
in Europe, which not all countries,
in
sure.
In Germany.
I don't know about that.
You have to earn your benefits. You have to go out and do voluntary work for it. You don't just get given it willy nilly.
And when you say you
there's also a culture of also sky high rents in this country, where the understandably these people they go out to work and their thinking is of the lines, if I earn £1,000, £1,500, £2,000 a month, whatever, half of my salary goes out to rent. Then the rest goes to council tax and bills. What's the point in going to work when I'm just get it for free?
When you said that you, well, that's one way of putting it. Yeah, I mean, it's also an argument for people to earn more and for rents to be capped. But when you said that you'd employed a lot of people, in what sort of industry?
In the construction industry.
Ah. And your experience
and
of young
industry
your,
as well.
Your experience of young people in the construction industry is what?
Well, I mean, you know, don't turn up for work on time. They've been on the alcohol the night before. And when you're dealing in dangerous industries like that, you know, you can't have alcohol in your system. Glued to their mobile phones, leaving early, disappearing, lots of stuff. And also the electronics industry as well.
The construction industry is got a bit of a problem, though, with age, doesn't it? Because the people that are, like, bricklayers, for instance, I think the average age of a bricklayer is about 55 in this country now. They're all looking at retirement, but they're not being replaced. So is it possible that the construction industry itself needs to up its game in order to make its positions more attractive to young people?
Well, there's lots of things with the construction industry. One, you can't just walk on a construction site now. You've got to have a CSCS card. You've got to have various training for the skills or trades that you're in. So I don't know where the government are coming up with these ideas, because unless they're going to pay for the training, it's like the care industry. You've got to be vetted. You can't just walk into the care industry. If you've got a police conviction, you won't get it. The security industry is another industry. You know, you've got to have a security industry authority license. All these industries have to have qualifications and licenses. Your other caller touched on that earlier about people with convictions and stuff.
Is it possible that what we're looking at here is a sort of forced free labour for companies that will essentially have a rolling tide of cheap labour coming in, spending 6 months there, then leaving to be replaced by another freebie?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, what's the point in doing it for 6 months? It's got to be a permanent position, or there's no incentive to stay there, is there? They just think, oh, it's another 6 months, and then I can get my benefits again. There's no incentive to. Well, what's the point in doing it on a temporary basis? I mean, you heard about the Birmingham bin strikers. All the bin strikers were on strike up in Birmingham, or were. They were replaced by agency workers, and they went on strike because they can't afford to live on the minimum wage. So, you've got to make things permanent, more permanent, and there's got to be a carrot at the end of it. If you don't earn enough to pay your outgoings or your bills or anything, well, then of course they're just going to say, oh, well, I'll just claim benefits. The taxpayer, good old taxpayer, can pay for it.
Good to talk to you, Paul. Thanks so much for that. 0345-6060-973. Just to let you know that we're going to continue with this after the news, so if you're waiting to talk to me, fear not. I'm not going to clear the board just up to the news. We'll continue this in the next hour. A lot of people want to talk about this. Michelle in Sidcup says, this is just literally a reincarnation of the Kickstart scheme, which ended up with very few young people being kept on permanently at the end of the scheme. This is just a box-ticking exercise from a pathetic government who are failing everyone, but especially the young generation. Well, it's difficult to know other than this what a government can do. Well, maybe that should be one of the questions. What else can a government do? If we've got almost a million young people who are out of work, they're not in training, they're not in education, some of them have been in that position for a good long while, and, you know, at that age, it's a considerable period of your working life. If, 18 months out of work for an 18-year-old, for instance, I mean, that's pretty much all of the time since they've been in school. So what else could a government do other than try their best to open up positions and sort of winkle pick these kids out from their bedrooms and push them out into the workplace under threat of losing the benefits that they are in receipt of? I can't think of anything. Perhaps you can. 0345-6060-973. Swindon, Nigel. Merthyr Tydfil. Hello, Jeff.
Hiya, Nick. A very interesting question, isn't it? Okay, let's get to it. In 1968, that's a long time ago, I was in digs. I was in university. One of 2%, not the 50% that go today, 2% went to university in 1968. Mm. And I shared it with two apprentices. But one was the Hoover's factory in Merthyr, the other was in British Steel in Port Talbot. They went on to get engineering degrees. The system was they left school when they were 15. They went into an apprenticeship, right? Apprenticeships then were in everything, water maintenance, building, bricklaying, electricians, the full works, everything you can think of. And they went into a factory. The factories encouraged them because the government encouraged, subsidized, basically. Hmm. 4 days in work, 2 days in the local technical college.
Yes.
They were then able to go on to whatever they wanted to do, and the peak of that would have been a BSc in engineering,
right,
in a university.
The difference one of the differences between then and now is that then we had a lot of factory work. We just don't have that now.
Yeah, but you've got the building trade, you've got the motor industry, you've got loads of other things like technical, media, whatever. You've got loads of stuff. If you can encourage some sort of, because the government are throwing money at what this, how much are they going to throw at it?
820 million.
What?
It's a life-changing event for you, an amount of money for you or me, Jeff, but in the great scheme of things, 820 million is over the next four years. It's not that much.
Well, then that system of apprenticeships and ability to go on, because I do not believe that young people don't want to work. I don't believe that, okay? What I would say to you is that brilliant system, and it was a brilliant system where all young people worked, then that was destroyed by Mrs. Thatcher, and she doesn't believe in society. And since then, the whole system has collapsed, and you have young people not working. And this is what that society was so much superior to then than today.
Yes, I think that work has ceased to be the route to a better life. I think work these days for a significant number of people is just a route to running furiously, to stand still, to just tick over, to not really go anywhere, doesn't have any future, these the sort of minimum wage going nowhere jobs, which seem to be proliferating, and all the decent work seems to be evaporating. But, well, go on.
Apprenticeships.
Yes.
Somehow or other, okay, you know, you want an answer? That's the answer. You have to involve young people at an early age, and with a future. You've got to offer them a future as well.
Yeah, it's a tricky moment to offer anybody a future, to confidently predict that whatever they go into now is still going to be something they can make money at in the future, because we're about to be upended. The entire world is going to be shaken AI. Like a snow globe the advance in artificial intelligence. And we won't know how bad that's going to be until we get there. Good talking to you, Jeff. Thanks for that. More of your calls on this subject after the news at 11 o'clock. You're listening to LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. Another government announcement is due to be made on tackling youth unemployment. Sir Keir Starmer will set out plans tomorrow on getting 50,000 younger people into newly created apprenticeships. Labour's already said it will help nearly a million to leave welfare and start working in the construction, care and hospitality industries. They could lose some payments if they refuse to engage with the process. The trade union organiser Aisha Malik-Smith has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC she is not convinced.
This is very much a short-term fix. It may well be the catalyst to getting more people into work, but I have so many concerns about the use of sanctions, about the short-term nature of this, and about the already poor conditions in the sectors that they're looking at.
A man's been arrested, but police say they're still looking for more people after 21 were hurt during a pepper spray attack at Heathrow Airport. They think four men robbed a woman of her suitcase at a multi-storey car park this morning. A man's been charged with murder in Hampshire after an 18-year-old was stabbed to death on Wednesday. The 22-year-old from Southampton is due before magistrates tomorrow. Russia is welcoming a new national security plan, which has been announced by the White House. It says the Trump administration wants improved relations with the Kremlin, and ending the Ukraine war is key to establishing strategic stability with Moscow. Vladimir Zelensky is due to meet with Sir Keir Starmer in London tomorrow, along with the leaders of Germany and France. Professor Anthony Glees has been telling LBC this could be an important gathering.
What the E3, that is to say Starmer, Merz and Macron, are going to say is that the truth has to be some kind of a deal will have to be accepted, and it's probably going to be a bad deal for Ukraine, but better than anything else.
And shipping containers full of bananas and other fruit have washed up in Sussex after falling overboard from a cargo ship off the Isle of Wight. The Maritime Coast Guard Agency says 16 came off the Baltic Clipper near the Nab Tower Lighthouse off Bembridge. LBC weather, dry with clear spells for much of the country overnight and feeling mild. Heavy showers, including hail and thunder, though, will affect the southwest during the early hours. We'll see a low of around 5 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
So we're talking about the government having identified a problem of young people who are NEET, N-E-E-T, that is not in employment, education or training. There's just shy of a million of them, apparently. And they are trying to fashion a way to do something about it, to persuade to persuade companies to offer 6 months fully subsidised roles for 25 hours a week, paid at the legal minimum wage, to get these young people to join the workforce. That's the one side. The other side is to try to get the young people to want to join in this scheme. And the stick is that they will be stripped of their rights to claim benefits if they refuse one of these positions. I should point out that it is going to be focused on six areas initially: Birmingham and Solihull, the East Midlands, Greater Manchester, Hertfordshire and Essex, Central and Eastern Scotland, and Southwestern, Southeastern Wales. It is just shy of 1 million people in total who are on universal credit and are looking for work, or maybe they're not looking for work. And those are the people that the government is trying to address for the benefit of all of us. Because, you know, if somebody leaves school and is unemployed for their whole life, then they will be costing the nation greatly in poor health outcomes and the lack of the tax that they would be paying and the increase in benefits bills, etc. So it's certainly worth doing something about. It's for long-term gain, which is not something that that many governments feel comfortable investing in, because they probably won't be around to reap the political benefit. But it's the long-term gain of the nation, and for these young people in particular, it is naturally controversial. And if you can think of another way of addressing this problem, then I'll be delighted to take your call. 0345 6060973. But what do you think of this policy? Reigate. Hello, Simon.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, just, I phoned up because I'm really genuinely concerned about young people in this country. I'm early 50s. I'm 51. I've had quite a difficult time recently, but it's mainly to do with sort of separation. I ended up having to go to the DWP. I get a tiny amount of support, but it was quite an interesting window into the world of the DWP, and I felt very strongly that they were good people, that there are a lot of lost people in that place, and that they really are stuck. Now I would say that it's a confidence issue with a lot of young people, and you know, I think there's so many problems with it. But I also felt that the people of the DWP, they understand the crisis themselves, because I feel they feel the pinch as well. So they're quite sympathetic with the people that go there, I think. I heard a young chap turning down the idea of working in hospitality. And, you know, living in the southeast, I can't really blame them, because, you know, the wages, everyone knows that hospitality is almost on its knees. And I don't think you can force people into professions they don't want to go into. But if you could secure really good work, proper employment with proper training and not some kind of fudge, then it's a brilliant idea. And I think it's essential. We need to get young people off their mobile phones, give them more confidence, get them into something that's going to, you know, realize they have a path to securing a home, which they might see as a mountain, you know, unattainable. But yeah, I'm all for it if it can be done. Now, I actually thought that someone told me in the week that Britain had the highest level of landlord-owned properties in Europe. I know that's not true now, because I was thinking everyone says Germany has a lot of people that rent. So a lot of people rent in Germany and Switzerland. I think in Eastern Europe, most people own their own home. That's probably a geographical, availability of land, etc. But I do think that I do think the government putting tax on the landlords is not great, because they're just going to pass that on to the tenants. I do think we have a crisis of confidence in the young people, because they see owning a property and getting on the property ladder quite a daunting task.
Impossible for most people these days, I would think. They can't imagine that they will ever be able to do that, which is, it's the first generation, I think, at least since the Second World War, that is going to be poorer than their parents.
Yeah, exactly, and I think that is really, really concerning. Now, I don't really want to go into my situation specifically, but I kind of feel I've let my children down a little bit. My job now is to make sure they have the best chance they can possibly have, you know, to do well. So I'm really, really keen that as my children get older, I will not sort of, I'll make sure that they get any opportunities that are around. They get the best opportunities to learn.
That is a good parent, but of course it should not be necessary. It wasn't necessary before. You somebody in an ordinary job could be the head of the household and only one of the parents would work, and they'd be able to own their own home and all of the other things that are completely out with the expectation of young people these days. You can understand why they would be reluctant to particularly go to minimum wage work. It's because what kind of a life is that? You work 8 hours a day, you could work 7 days a week, and you still would barely be able to afford your rent and your council tax, and you might be able to go out for a night once a week, if you're lucky. It's no kind of life, it's just an existence, isn't it? So if that's the world of work, then it's kind of understandable that young people who have little experience of it might think, well, what's the point? Thank you, Simon. Appreciate that. 0345 6060 973. Swindon, Nigel.
Hello.
Nigel.
Yeah, thanks very much. What you need to do is stop these young people making a lifetime career out of not working. And their payment for it is their dole money. Now, I suggest that they meet up at 9 a.m. a public place. Could be McDonald's, KFC, a church, or even a private address where they can leave their umbrellas and push bikes if they need to. And if they don't turn up, they have to wait till 12 o'clock before they can go home. That way, if they don't turn up, they make excuses. I mean, I'm 80, and I've worked up to my retirement age and beyond. But there's people that makes a lifetime career out of it. And I've seen it locally. Yeah, and it's not good. And those that don't want to work will make all sorts of excuses. Bad back, got something wrong with me. Well, then you should have a dole office doctor, because they can go to the doctor and he can't see a backache. So they get off with that way. So if they had a dole office doctor that checks the suspect people out, then that would be a good idea.
Well, Pat McFadden did say that they would need a good reason to decline one of the placements that is going to be rolled out from next April. So maybe there would be some sort of, I don't know whether there would actually be a check to see whether somebody actually has, like you say, a bad back or not. But so your impression is that young people today do not have the same work ethic that people of your generation did.
Absolutely. There's some people that are generally looking for work, or some can't work because of mental illness or whatever. But then you get the career who stay on their dole for a lifetime, and they buy houses while they're on the dole.
Not sure about that, Nigel. They might have done in the 1960s, but I don't think they'd be able to do that now. Not now, no. But appreciate that call. Thanks, Nigel. Can't get the image of young people showing up at Kentucky Fried Chicken on their bicycles with their umbrellas. It's a beautiful thought. Leytonstone. Hello, Robert.
Hello there. How are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I think that the scheme is worth a try. It is worth a go. And I think it can actually succeed. And that will depend quite, Mary, on the job centres finding the appropriate person and putting them forward. And it should be those that are wanting to do so. There's no point wasting money if the person doesn't want to do it. And the thing is, for the job centres to actually decide, like they do now, on certain criteria of the youngster as to whether it's appropriate to put them forward or not. Now, let's assume that they find someone who is wanting to go forward on the scheme and they think they have a job or a company that will take them on. Now, there's two aspects to this for me. One is fairness and the other is economy. Now, as far as fairness goes, I think that people who are getting perhaps closer to retirement and pensions and that, there's a whole story there that I can give you a solution for, but it's too complex and too long. But they should be prepared, some of them, to make way for youngsters, given the scenario, the global market, or what it is.
So what you need is companies that also want to take part of this and lower their costs. And
their costs? How do you mean their costs?
Right. So if a company can take on somebody and they take somebody on and that person does quite well and they want to keep that person on, then what they can do is have somebody at the top end of the sort of age range that's quite senior retiring, moving out, and everybody else in the company kind of like moves up one slot,
right,
to take over that position.
They shorten the conveyor belt of employment.
Sort of, yes, but that's where we've got to look at fairness today. And the elderly people have got to make way for youngsters. And there's a benefit, economy-wise, for those elderly to do so as well. So for all of us, or for the UK. And the youngsters, if they're successful, keep the job, it's great for them. It is. If the person doesn't succeed, it's unfortunate, but he's gained a little bit of experience and time, maybe, that person wanted to get, and it might help him find another job if he's done some work already. He's more attractive to companies to employ. So for the youngsters, it's good. Now, for the economy, the UK, we have to be competitive globally, and companies that can probably lower their costs, because as everybody moves through the conveyor belt, they probably are in a position where the reward payment for the job comes down, if you
right,
like.
Because they'd be, they'd be shedding older, more experienced people who would have been there longer, therefore are paid more, and they're replacing them with people who are perhaps on minimum wage.
Well, no, they're not going to do that. The people are moving through the conveyor belt. So those that are 40s will be taking positions of those in 50s. So those at 40s are not going to be on minimum wage. They're less likely to be.
Hmm.
So that isn't true there. So it's just that when they move to that position, higher position,
yeah,
they probably won't necessarily get an increase in payment, their wages,
right,
too much.
It's
cheaper for the company.
Yes, it sounds like you're just lowering the retirement age.
Well, that's, yeah, and I have a solution for that, but it's, as I said, it's complex. The scheme, though, is good, and I think people need to give it support and give it a go. It's well worth trying, it's well worth doing, and you're going to find that you're going to have to sort of do this type of thing in other ways as well, other schemes. So it must, I think, be given a go to see how it goes. And if it works, keep it going. If it doesn't, well, just give it up.
All right. Good to talk to you, Robert. Thanks for that. So what do you make of this? There's about a million young people, 16 to 24-year-olds, who are idle, essentially. They're not in education, they're not in employment, and they're not in training. And that is pretty serious for them now, but also the country in the future, because all of those people will find it more and more difficult to get work the longer they stay out of work. I mean, you are much more attractive as a prospective employee if you already have a job. And the longer you go as a young person without work, then the less likely you are to be able to sort of acclimatise yourself to a work environment. So something's got to be done. I wonder if you think that this is just the very thing, that the government is offering six-month roles. They will be fully subsidised for companies. The roles will be paid at the legal minimum wage. And if the young people who are offered these roles refuse them, I don't know whether they only get one go, whether a refusal is counted as your final answer. I mean, I would suggest that that might be a bit unfair, but the idea is that if you refuse the work, then the government will refuse to give you your benefits. What do you make of that? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
This is LBC.
At Fidelity, we've been helping our customers plan for their retirements for nearly 20 years. From understanding how much you'll need to combining multiple pensions, we offer expert insights, excellent service, and even financial advice, so you can feel confidently invested in your future. For pensions, advice or investment accounts, be invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Transferring is not right for everyone. Terms apply.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard your flight to Geneva. This is your captain speaking, and I would like to take a second to welcome our very special guests, all the skis and snowboards that enjoy a free flight to Winter Wonderland.
The best winter holidays start with the right airline. Book your family trip to Winter Wonderland now on Swiss.com and enjoy free gear transport.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We are talking about the government's attempts to tackle the young people who are not in employment, education or training. What are your thoughts on the plans as I have outlined them? Brighton. Hello, Sarah.
Oh, hi, Nick. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just ringing because I think that quite a lot of people are sort of quite unfair to young people. And I want to talk about affection of young people that have done everything they're meant to do, like gone to university, got debts, etc., but are still unemployed due to mismanagement of successive governments. So my example is workforce planning in the NHS. So my son is a doctor, so he's been a doctor for 2 years, and doctors, when they've been doctors for 2 years, they go into specialty training. And due to Boris Johnson dropping the resident labour market test in 2020, now my son has to compete not only with the British medical graduates, but also international medical graduates. So he's now currently unemployed. So he basically 67% of applications to specialist training in 2025 were for international medical graduates. So
really?
At the moment, yeah. So it was 20,802 international medical graduates applied for around 12,000 places and about 12,000 UK medical graduates. But before Boris Johnson dropped the resident labour market test in 2020...
And what is that, for those that don't know? What is the resident labour market test?
So what it would do is it would look... So for doctors, I only know it for doctors. So it would look to see, basically, if a British person could fill the job. And
right.
If they could, then... so basically...
They would be prioritised.
They were, yeah, exactly. Now, Wes Streeting in June and July was wafting around saying that he was going to put back prioritisation for UK medical graduates.
Hmm.
And he has actually done nothing. So he's been in post about 18 months, and this is a massive problem. So we're talking about, specialty training is where our doctors become GPs or consultants,
yeah,
or surgeons.
They choose the specialists,
exactly,
that they will take with them throughout their career in the NHS.
Yeah. And so that has fed into the doctor strike because the doctors are fuming. So if you went on to Reddit or any of the Twitter, the fury is not so much about the pay, it's about the fact that they are competing, like 37% of the applicants were UK graduates, medical graduates, and 67% were international medical graduates. So that is where the fury is coming. But the thing is that what can an unemployed doctor do? He's picking up some locum shifts, but it's a very scary time for him, and there's about 22,000 other doctors are like that. And then we've got massive waiting lists, and we've got people in A&E for like 18 hours sitting on chairs not being seen. It just seems like an absolute madness.
Well,
are not prioritising our graduates.
Yes, well, it certainly seems disconnected. I'm unfamiliar with this, although I have heard of doctors, what we used to call junior doctors, who have come out of like 5-6 years of training already, with getting on for six-figure debt hanging over their head.
Yeah,
100,000. Despite the fact that we are desperately in need of medical professionals, they find it impossible to get work, which just seems completely insane.
And also the thing is that it's not a level playing field. So international medical graduates have often been doctors for like 10, 20 years. Mm. But the specialty training is for men and women that have been doctors for 2 years.
Yeah.
So you get points for things like international papers, or, you know, things that somebody who's been doing an F1 or F2 job wouldn't have access to do, either money-wise or time-wise.
Mm.
So basically, they're not even... So the point system is actually... favouring international medical graduates.
Right. Well, that is a very serious situation, and the government should certainly be looking at that. It's not really related to the topic at hand, though. I mean, I guess if it's 16 to 24, then some 24-year-olds might come under that category if they...
Yes. But
you know, we don't want somebody who's been trained as a doctor at vast expense to be going on to a building site to be a basic labourer. That's a very particular skill that they have, and as we are in want of people with those skills, then we should be using them to for their benefit and ours. Thanks for that, Sarah. I've got to move on. 0345 6060 973. Steve says, when I first had to sign on for benefits in my teens, I couldn't get my head around being given money and giving nothing back in return. It was a short-term thing while I found a job. I asked if I was supposed to be doing something basic, like picking up litter, and they said, you can do that if you want to, but no, you didn't have to. So I cleared up a load of litter in the park on the way home. I don't mind people who can work doing voluntary work. My last job as an agency temp was as a road sweeper with a barrow. And they had to tell me to stop working and go home because it wasn't done to my satisfaction, and I was working extra hours unpaid. Huh. The guy on the shift before me was too ill to work, so it just wasn't done. He shouldn't have been there. Put a big strain on me, says Steve. Right, so he was surprised that there was the government giving out benefits in his teens, and he didn't, and they didn't require him to do anything in return. Well, I guess that's what's happening now. Young people will be stripped of their right to claim benefits if they refuse a taxpayer-funded job after 18 months being without a job. What do you make of that? Leeds, Tyler.
Mr. Abbott, well, just that last call, if we have unemployed junior doctors working on building sites, at least it might make them a little bit safer if there's accidents. I don't think it's a good policy, though, this announcement. I think it's a false economy, because it'll be like YTS. You'll have young people recruited for 6 months who were then sort of sacked, and then it'll just lead to more long-term unemployment. But more particularly, I think that the problem with the welfare budget is the pensions. £50 billion a year goes towards it. Universal credit, 40% of people are in work. I think we need to get rid of the triple lock because it's starving the country. And I think I'm, as a young person, as with Gen Z, we're quite sick of old boomers being right mardy when they had cheap houses, free university, they had European Union access, you know, they had wages were higher in compared to like living standards and everything. So I don't think you should be blaming us for the problems that you created. And I think it's a completely unjust fact that the triple lock is destroying the British economy. That's the problem that is stopping business investment, that's stopping programs for like actually getting young people into work, that's preventing money from being put into like regional areas with like devolution. And I just think people need to get a bit of a grip and stop. Like, you can have a personal opinion, but you need to disconnect that from an actual policy that helps the country as a whole, is my opinion.
Yes, when people criticize the benefits bill, and the right wing press will do this on a regular basis, and they'll have in mind somebody, they'll paint a picture of some youth with his feet up, smoking a cigar, watching daytime television. But that's not where most of the benefits bill goes. Most of the benefits bill is, as you say, goes to state pension.
And they're economically inactive. And I think as well, you know, I don't understand it. Older people, you had so much more opportunities. And I think that the fact that you're blaming young people for the problems of this country is an indictment on your own beliefs. And I think the right wing press as well, well, they're just trying to divide and conquer people rather than sort of focusing everyone's minds on what would actually work to improve things. Like David Scaife in North Yorkshire, he was given £10 million last year for a skills trailblazer. He recruited 1,500 new workers, helped 500 businesses, and the announcement from Pat McFadden, who I think is one of the worst ministers in this country's history, is going to spend £820 million, and the projections they released last year, yesterday, said they're only planning on 1,000 people a year being under this
well,
program.
Well, no, they weren't planning on it.
They weren't planning on it.
They said they expect more than 1,000 young people to start a job in the first 6 months of the scheme.
And that is...
Hang on a minute. That 820 million is over the next 4 years. And I think that in giving us that number, they are actually sort of lowballing it in order to manage our expectations. Mm-hmm. And they will be able to say, well, you know, we did far more than 1,000, so we have outperformed, even our,
our best accountant team.
Exactly. All right, good talking to you, Tyler. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. He's got a point, you know. This country was like this when he got here. Giles says the existence of jobs allows people to be in work. The existence of jobs allows people to be in work. We are losing 1,000 jobs a week due to this government's employers' national insurance increase and are due to lose more due to the coming rates reviews, let alone the additional running costs. Workers' rights are irrelevant if the jobs don't exist. This government is a joke. Yeah, I don't think that you can pin the state of the nation on this government, not after 14 years of the Tories smashing it up. I know, I've said this loads of times, but I know Keir Starmer looks like Harry Potter's dad, but he's not a wizard. 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850, email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you are on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973. In a related topic, I'm going to take more of your calls on this, but when I come out of the news, the headmaster of a top public school has said, we are too quick to label teenagers as having anxiety, and thereby letting them use that as an excuse not to work. Do you think that he's right? Or are we denying the scale of the potential mental health crisis among children and others? 0345 6060 973. It's 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Another government announcement is due to be made on tackling youth unemployment through newly created apprenticeships. Labour's already said it will help nearly a million young people to leave welfare and start working in construction, care and hospitality. A man's been charged with murder in Hampshire after an 18-year-old was stabbed to death on Wednesday. The 22-year-old from Southampton is due before magistrates tomorrow. And shipping containers full of bananas and other fruit have washed up in Sussex after falling overboard from a cargo ship off the Isle of Wight. The Maritime Coast Guard Agency says 16 came off the Baltic Clipper off Bembridge. LBC weather, dry with clear spells for most of the country overnight and feeling mild. Heavy showers later, including some hail and thunder in the southwest. We'll see a low of around 5 degrees.
This is LBC.
Waitrose presents.
And the main event.
One cook learns that love doesn't always shout.
Enough for me.
Sometimes it whispers.
I saved you the best bit, Dad.
Starring succulent number one free-range turkey bauble wrapped in dry-cured beetroot smoked bacon with cranberry jeweled pork stuffing and orange glaze.
Ooh, thanks.
Waitrose, the home of food lovers. Subject to availability and delivery slots, available to order online and in stores from 19th of December.
While all the Whos of Whoville were at McDonald's eating, the Grinch from his lair started plotting and scheming. Gherkin-flavored fries and odd socks will send them crackers. So try the Grinch's new meal and head down to Macca's.
Until 4th of Jan from 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary while stocks last. Grinched for adults.
40 million people listen to commercial radio each week. That's 80 million ears, give or take. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org.
When you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you.
Life feels better with a smile. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Modern, comfortable and affordable dentistry for all. See online for our price match promise. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling.
BanningDental.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Health Secretary Wes Streeting announced last week that an independent review would be held into the diagnosis of mental health conditions in the face of soaring numbers of sufferers. Let's talk about this with Dr. Will Shield. Dr. Shield is a child and educational psychologist at the University of Exeter and joins us on the line. Good evening, Doctor.
Hello, good evening.
The numbers are really quite startling, aren't they? Between 2019 and 2024, apparently the number of 16 to 34-year-olds off work with mental health conditions went up by 76%. Do you take that on face value, or are we perhaps in the midst of a fad for labelling any unpleasant emotion as a mental illness?
I think it's a really hard kind of discussion argument to have. I think we need to recognise that diagnosis rates have risen across many countries at significant rates over several years, but the research is still really unclear about whether these increased numbers reflect greater awareness or more assessment routes, broader criteria, and so on. I think we also can't ignore the fact that society is a very stressful place, and I think we're at risk of pathologising or medicalising everyday human experience through trying to find an understanding or a label or a diagnosis to explain why some people find life so tricky at times. But there's a real call, I think, for this understanding of why are we overdiagnosing? Are we overdiagnosing? Or are we actually helping people by helping them to understand themselves? There's a real risk with ADHD and anxiety and labels or diagnoses like this, but they don't explain any causality. They don't help us understand why we experience life and the way we experience it. They just give a label to our experiences. And that can be both helpful and unhelpful to people, I think.
Yeah, ADHD testing of British women went up 3,200% in the 2 years from 2019. Are internet influencers and the peddlers of quack remedies persuading people that they have a mental illness where in fact they don't?
I would take a kinder approach to that statement and wonder about whether influencers are actually trying to be helpful by spreading their experience of life and their experience of diagnosis. But that's not always helpful, because although those stories are powerful to those individuals, there's not always an understanding that's not the same experience for everybody. So we can open TikTok or we can open Instagram, and suddenly our algorithm gives us a host of stories that tells us all about how life is really hard and these are the things to look for in ADHD diagnoses. But actually, when we come down to it, the criteria are often quite different than that. And again, there's a real positive in spreading awareness and people not feeling the stigma so much, but also that over sort of understanding or the broadening of criteria. And when we get down to those actual diagnostic criteria, people often feel very conflicted, I guess, by the fact that their experience doesn't quite map onto those criteria that we have that are internationally recognised.
Yes, I mean, somebody who goes onto social media or the internet in general and they start to look up whatever symptoms they have, then they're down a dangerous path, aren't they? Because if you do it with, you know, whatever ailment you may feel that day, however insignificant, then there'll be some website that tells you you've got a combination of typhoid, malaria and the flu.
Yeah, incredibly. Well, exactly the same mental health. You know, we can plug our systems into ChatGPT, so symptoms into ChatGPT or Google, and suddenly we get all kinds of mental health diagnoses. And that is really the issue with the mental health diagnoses, is that some people argue there's no such thing as a mental health diagnosis, because rarely is there a biological marker that underpins everybody's diagnostic label, if you like, because when we give a diagnosis of ADHD or anxiety or, you know, any of these symptoms, any of these categories, we're just describing people's experience rather than understand there's a causality to this. So it's really easy to go down a web of Googling and using AI to come up with all kinds of unhelpful diagnoses, I think.
Yeah, autism is another condition that has had an explosion of people who claim or have been diagnosed as suffering from it, 800% up between 1998 and 2018. The US Secretary of Health, he's addressed this issue. He said it's environmental toxins, which is among the least crazy things that he's said. It could be that, perhaps, or could it be an expansion of the diagnostic definition of autism that is actually behind these huge increases in numbers?
Again, I think research is needed into this, because research has said for a long time that prevalence hasn't increased. We're just getting better recognising autism. But again, I meet lots of young people, so lots of children and families I work with who are, you know, starting school, coming to school, and concerns have existed for a long time about their child's development. They're waiting on these 2, 3, 4 year pathways to find out whether their child would meet the criteria for diagnosis of autism. And all of that worry and stress they have for several years just builds. And they then put a lot on the fact that a diagnosis may or may not come. But once you have a diagnosis, there's absolutely no support often that comes with that. So we, certainly in education, we work to a needs-led model of support, whereby we will always support the needs rather than the label diagnosis. But actually, it's a really difficult system where you've got parents who are incredibly worried and stressed about their child's development from an early age, actually being told, you need to wait for a long time, and then we're going to give you a diagnostic label that leads to no extra support. So I think we're in this situation where we don't really know why diagnosis is increasing as it is. What we do know is that the pressures on the NHS and the public sector lead people into the private sector and looking for private diagnoses. And it's big business. You know, if you Google how to get an ADHD diagnosis, how to get an autism diagnosis, you're presented with lists of providers who actually have all now got huge weights in this as well. So I think we are in this very difficult situation whereby whether you go to the public sector or the private sector, you're waiting for a diagnosis, and that in itself fuels anxiety and worry, which is really unhelpful, I think, for lots of families.
Yes, I mean, it's a limited resource that the NHS has in order to deal with these problems. And is it perhaps part of, or if not the problem, to get the help to where it's needed, that a practitioner is seeing just a sea of people, all of whom have the same diagnosis, but it's very difficult to know which one is the which one sort of presents the most needy picture for the most immediate treatment?
So I think we're talking about differential diagnosis there. When we're looking at, is this ADHD, is this autism, you know, what label is right for this? In my profession as an educational psychologist, we're not directly involved in diagnosis, but we often feed into the diagnostic process. And my experience of working with NHS teams and health service teams is they still carry out a really thorough, really comprehensive diagnosis that involves often other professionals like speech and language therapists, community pediatricians, psychiatrists, psychologists. And that gives a really rigorous understanding of that child's developmental history to date. So I think that the diagnostic criteria are being applied fairly and robustly in my experience. But I know that's not always the experience of families who are going through the process at the same time.
Yeah, so you don't think that it is perhaps time-poor and harassed medics who are just signing off on someone's stated self-diagnosis of having a mental illness just to get a, you know, to have an easy life?
Absolutely not. I mean, when you look at the rigorous assessments that families go through with NHS, you can really see that although there's hundreds of children waiting for that assessment too, they don't skimp on that assessment just because of the waiting list. They maintain that kind of very ethical, very values-driven approach whereby this is about understanding the child in their context and not giving a diagnosis should it not be fit at that point in time.
But they surely have a lot of pressure from either parents or the subject themselves, because they would have sort of convinced themselves that they have something that is wrong with them before they present to a medical professional. So I would imagine that that professional feels under an enormous pressure to confirm what the patient thinks and has thought before they arrived in their office.
My experience is that as health professionals, we're trained to deal with that, and we're trained to not always give the news that people expect to hear, but that is right at that point in time based on the evidence we have in front of us. I think we have to look at, you know, if you look at the wider special education needs and disability kind of crisis, the media calls it, with education healthcare plans and funding in schools and that broader system, I think often the worry the parents have is because they want their child to be supported through their early years of school and into secondary school and college and so forth. And actually, our job has to be to make sure that we're giving the right information to the right people at the right time, and really also advocating and calling for proper resourcing at an early stage to preventative support in schools and in preschool settings and nurseries. And my experience of, you know, being a psychologist for a long time now is that that's all changed and that support has really peeled back. And as that support has disappeared, parents and families have become more worried about their children because there's no one to talk to at the early stage. So they wait to that point in time, 4 years down the line, where they get their assessment meeting. And that's the first time often they have a chance to speak to a health professional about all of their concerns. So I think it's a big job for that practitioner at that point in time, but I don't experience people feeling pressured to give diagnoses where they're not fit.
Right, well, we started this conversation with you unsure about whether what was behind the actual increase in these numbers. One of the possibilities you suggested was that there may be overdiagnosis. And the very fact that the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, announced this review into the diagnosis of mental health conditions rather suggests that or implies that perhaps there has been over-diagnosis, or they may be just trying to get to the bottom of whatever has caused it. But that's one reading. And are we at the stage now where mental illness used to be something that we did not talk about? It was, it was the one illness that was not discussed. Now it's changed, and it's good that reluctance to address it is gone. But has it perhaps been replaced by a sort of refusal to be questioned about a self-diagnosis?
Self-diagnosis itself is an interesting area because, again, that comes from often older adolescents looking at social media and identifying with our symptoms, as we talked about previously. I do feel that a personal and a professional view, that looking at whether there is overdiagnosis, and if so, why that is helpful, as long as we don't start invalidating people's experiences and saying that it's great we talk about mental health. It's a real challenge, I think, if we start invalidating people who have really quite significant experience of mental health needs, and their experience is likened to somebody else, because suddenly two people have a diagnosis of anxiety, yet somebody's is far more situational than someone whose is long-standing and really difficult to manage their life. Has a real impact across all aspects of their work and home and personal relationships and things. So I think it's really good that we're having an overhaul, or kind of certainly a look at the system. But I really hope that one of the outcomes of that is that more support is in place for people who feel that life is really difficult and they are able to access support when they need support, rather than several years down the line when things have just escalated and got to a place where it feels unmanageable.
Of course, the big difference between the young generation today and previous ones is the phone in their pockets. To what extent do you think people are ascribing mental illness to the effects of being addicted to their phones and the sort of hyper-competitive world of unreal expectations that is social media?
We're taught, aren't we, to have a very short attention span now. We've seen a real change in how films are filmed and TV programs are filmed. If we look back at 50 years ago, the length of scenes on films and TV shows compared to now. And now we're in this world where we're scrolling, we're moving through things very quickly, and we're getting lots of stimulation from our devices. I talked about this with my friends the weekend, actually, about how we're all in this mode of saying, well, might we all have ADHD because we're so used to moving so quickly and trying really to keep up and be distracted and multitask and do all these different things at the same time. So there's definitely an element of phones and social media usage. And I think when we talk about mental health conditions and diagnoses, we have to say the context and consideration. So to come back to an earlier point, being able to diagnose based on these are six things that lead to ADHD, I think is quite unhelpful without taking to the context of a person's life, which includes their use of social media, which includes their family relationships, their work relationships, the community they live in, and all the different stress in their life and their early experience as well. So I think it's certainly an aspect that we have to consider.
What about the effect of COVID? In your opinion, what effect has COVID had on all of this?
From a school perspective, we saw a huge increase in children feeling unable to leave the house or come to school post-COVID. We have huge amounts of children who are now being labelled as having EBSA, so anxiety-based school refusal or kind of school avoidance. And I think when we try and unpick COVID, again, it adds a new layer of complexity. When we look at younger children, we have a group of children who weren't given those early experiences of socialising with children the same way that lots of other children have. We know we've got an explosion of speaking language needs at an early age now, so 5-6-year-olds, lots of work going in there because they were that kind of cohort COVID, the COVID cohort of children that didn't get kind of nurseries and baby sensory and those experiences. So again, I think COVID had a real impact and we're still unpicking what the impact is. And I think research will carry on trying to unpick that for a long time.
Very good to talk to you, Doctor. Thanks so much for your time. That's Dr. Will Shield, child and educational psychologist at the University of Exeter. So it's a related topic to what we were talking about earlier on. I mean, if you are suffering from a mental illness, presumably that is one of the things that would excuse you from this new scheme that the government has to try to wheedle young people into the jobs market by stripping them of their right to claim benefits if they refuse a taxpayer-funded job without a good reason. What are your thoughts on that? 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Would she lie to you? Part one.
As part of cutting the debt and the borrowing, I was really upfront. I wanted to increase the size of the headroom against my fiscal rules.
Would she lie to you? Part two.
We now read that she's misled us about being the under 14 British girls chess champion. Is this checkmate for the Chancellor?
I'm absolutely thrilled that she's finally being caught out on this chess thing.
The World, according to Rachel Reeves, hits a collision course next week as she faces a post-budget showdown in front of a panel of MPs. They think it's all OBR for the Chancellor. It could be now.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
So, what's on your to-do list today? Why don't you check if you're eligible for pension credit? It tops up your pension income and also opens up help with heating bills, council tax, and more. Search pension credit on gov.uk or call 0800 99 1234. There's nothing to lose. Check today. Pension credit. Credit where credit's due. Eligibility criteria apply.
This festive season at McDonald's, get
rich deals every day.
Okay, okay.
With a sausage sandwich for just...
Let's see, 9 and MP.
6 chicken McNuggets for just...
9 and MP.
Fine. Get Grinch deals every day
in the McDonald's app.
18 plus app only. Ends 24th of December. One use per offer. Fees apply to delivery. Participation varies. T's and C's apply.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
Do it for your wife, who told you to pick up bread, but instead you picked up Fred, your grandson, again. And now your daughter is calling because he missed football. That's the fourth time this month. You can wave his future career goodbye. If you don't do it for you, do it for your wife and little Freddy.
New In, the latest custom-fit rechargeable hearing devices. Discreet, comfortable, and smart enough to help you catch every moment. Book a free hearing test at bootshearingcare.com. T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
We're talking about the government policy or this new scheme to strip young people of their rights to claim benefits if they refuse a taxpayer-funded job. This is after 18 months without a job. They'll be fully subsidised, these rules. They plan on offering about 350,000 over the next 4 years or so to 18 to 21-year-olds on universal credit who've been looking for work or without work or employment or training for 18 months. The positions will be at legal minimum wage for 25 hours a week. So what do you make of that? Is that a good idea, or can you think of perhaps a better way of trying to solve the problem of about a million young people idle, essentially? Bromley, Heather.
No, I'm from Swanley, not Bromley.
Oh, Swanley. Much nicer. Yeah.
And I do have very strong feelings about young people getting benefits after school.
Yeah.
They should be allowed to get a job, be offered a job, and work. And as for ADHD, there are too many young people leaving school with that title of ADHD, which often goes back to bad parenting. And I hate to say that, but I'm going to say it. As young children, you have a group of parents, youngish parents, who haven't taught their children and therefore are now being labelled as ADHD. They get extra money from the government once your child has been labelled. But do they not think or even care that that child is going to be labelled for life as having that notice of ADHD against their name?
Yeah,
well, I feel really strongly about that.
Well, Wes Streeting has purportedly looking into it. Of course, nobody can self-diagnose themselves with ADHD, and you know, as far as the medical profession is concerned, it's not something you can just say I've got this and therefore it's true. But I understand your concern. Thank you, Heather. Kirsty says, I have carers visit me at home every day, or I already have young people who are claiming universal credit who are forced into care work because they have to make up a certain amount of salary or they get sanctioned. These young people are not carers. They don't want to be carers, which means they cannot care properly or reliably. This is unfair on me and potentially dangerous. Yes, well, I did say earlier on that it seems like an area of potential problem, because social care is, as I said, it's a very particular set of skills, social care. It's almost like a calling for people. And if you're not fully on board with everything that goes with it, then it's probably best that you're not there. It doesn't really apply to the same extent to something like the building trade, for instance, or the hospitality sector. It's a very particular thing, is social care. Let's see. Bradford, Khalid.
Hello, Nick. Thank you for taking my call. So I've got a lot of experience working with young people, post 16, but I strongly feel that most young people actually just want to work. You know, if they were given the opportunity, they would always go for that. But I think what we're doing now, we're not necessarily preparing them for work as such, because, I mean, it's quite shocking, but I think about half the schools that are in secondary schools, that is year 10, 11, actually do work experience. So they're not really preparing them for the job market. So when they kind of go into social medias, all they're ever seeing is people who are sort of like cruising through life, you know, they're enjoying life. Yeah. They're not necessarily working.
It looks like that. They might not necessarily be living that life, but they make it look like they're living that life, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I've kind of worked, in fact, I delivered the Kickstart program some years ago, just post-COVID, and I've also done the Prince's Trust team program, and the Kickstart scheme was very successful. You know, I had young people that were leaving the Kickstart scheme that were earning way more than me in the company I was delivering the scheme. So there were really high-quality jobs that were there, but given the right support, given the right type of nurturing, given the right type of training, young people, and just they can fly, and I've seen that happen with that. But I've also, on the Prince's Trust team program, which is like a 12-week program, now known as the King's Trust program, that within that there's a 2-week work placement, and quite often when I used to approach employers, you know, right, can you take on a young person for work experience? Yes, there's a lot of anxiety, but I think that was misunderstood as being nervous. You know, so, you know, taking young people to an employer, introducing them to employer, showing them this is what you'll be doing, this is what it'll be like, this is the expectation. In fact, a lot of them excelled, they did really well. And a lot of the jobs they were going into, because it was only for 2 weeks, were hospitality, in hotels, so with some big chain hotels, restaurants, takeaways, had them working in nurseries, had them working in old people's care homes. And in these environments, some of them really excelled. And I think what the problem is that if you've never tried it, you really don't know what you're missing out on. And I myself, you know, my career started was I took a gamble on a job because I was on Job Seekers, right? A job I didn't want, and it became the best job ever, and I stuck with it. And
yes, it is very true that you, you know, and unless you have a real drive from an early age to do a particular thing, you know, some people do, some people are just sort of casting around for for something that suits them, well, they're not going to find it unless they do it. All right, good talking to you, Khalid. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. Hampstead, Isan.
Yes, hello, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Yes, basically, I have 4 points. I'm not a good speaker, but I'll try my best. First of all, I'm noticing the phrase senior citizen. It's been, I don't know what happened to it, but people are preferring to say elderly and so on. I think we have to go back to that phrase again, just to give them, the senior citizens, the respect they deserve for their contribution to the society and country. And, you know, then of course it comes naturally to show them that respect by, you know, having jumped the queue and, you know, some privileges, being their,
Well, the young would say that the older cohort among us have had no end of privileges their lives that young people will not be able to access at all.
Okay, that's a good concern. I'm addressing it as my third point, with bringing back the youth centers. I'm noticing that the youth centers have been cancelled or deleted by some previous governments. I think that should be brought back. Because, at least the youth can, and as well as the senior citizens can come to give their advice and have some communication with each other and to explore, whether any sport or apprentice or any talent they might have. So basically, I noticed that there's an imbalance in the whole, in that 1% owning, say, 50 to 70% of the wealth. That's an imbalance. So that needs to be addressed a little bit. I think the best way is for the very rich to sort of act like Robin Hood or King Arthur, be patriotic and get together with other billionaires and sort of bring some participation into the economy, whether housing or NHS and healthcare, sort of to become like the saviors of the economy,
they could do that, but every time somebody suggests that the rich pay more, what a reasonable person in the street might call their fair share, then the howling outrage would drown out the engines of a jet plane. We've been down that road before. They're not going to give a penny unless we actually extract it from them. And, my belief is that we should, because this is tinkering around the edges. That's the major problem that faces society, the total wealth imbalance, which is getting worse by the second. Thanks, Isan. After the break, we're going to discuss a bubbling conflict between Tommy Robinson and the Church of England.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. Millions of pounds are to be spent on protecting the UK's undersea links from Russian interference and sabotage. The Defence Secretary John Healey says the country and its allies are ready to begin tracking and deterring the Kremlin submarines through a hybrid naval force called Atlantic Bastion. Peter Dickinson from the Atlantic Council has been telling LBC Vladimir Putin is determined to reclaim Russia's Cold War authority.
When his representative is speaking English, they obviously talk about different things, but when he's speaking in Russian, he's very open. He talks about reclaiming ancient Russian lands. He talks about, reversing the historical injustices of the past. He talks about Ukraine as being Russian. He denies that it has any right to be independent. And this is really, this has been going on for more than a decade now. And he's really set this up as the defining issue of his entire reign.
More government measures aimed at getting young people into work are due to be announced by the Prime Minister later. Sir Keir Starmer's government is now looking to develop 50,000 apprenticeships at a cost of £725 million. It's already been publicising plans to get young people off benefits by creating placements in construction, hospitality and care. Nigel Farage is being urged to make a comment over claims his campaign to get elected as the Clacton MP broke the rules on spending. They've come from a former aide and an ex-reform councillor, as LBC's Holly Harris now explains.
There are reports the Metropolitan Police has been given documents supposedly showing Reform spent more than it should in the Essex constituency during last year's general election. The party strongly denied breaking the law and says it's looking forward to clearing its name. It also says Richard Everett, the alleged whistleblower, was expelled from Reform several months ago. But both Labour and the Conservatives are now claiming the Reform leader has questions to answer.
It's expected the leader of the Conservatives will use a news conference later to demand the government accelerates the creation of a national grooming gangs inquiry. It's believed Kemi Badenoch will also release a new draft terms of reference for the investigation. And the creator of Wallace and Gromit says Aardman Animations will embrace AI, but Nick Park says the company will also be very cautious so it doesn't lose its values. LBC weather, dry with clear spells for much of the UK overnight and feeling mild. Heavy showers, including some hail and thunder, will affect the southwest during the early hours. We'll see a low of around 5 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The Church of England is to launch a poster campaign aimed at challenging the anti-migrant message of Tommy Robinson, whose Unite the Kingdom movement has urged its supporters to join a carols event next weekend to, in their words, put the Christ back into Christmas. Let's talk about this with Wayman Bennett. Wayman is co-convener of the charity Stand Up to Racism and joins us on the line now. Hello, Wayman.
Hello, thank you so much for having me speak today.
I appreciate your time. It seems ironic that people who describe themselves as Christian nationalists would probably pack Jesus on the next plane to Rwanda if he ever came back to walk among us again.
Well, I agree with the vicar of St. Martin's, where he said that Jesus was a refugee to the Middle East, so they wouldn't have given him much time when he brought the question of love into the question of Christmas this year. I think that, to be honest, I think that Tommy Robinson and his followers are much more closer to Satan than they are to Jesus Christ as a follower. So maybe they're being true to their real person that they support, because Satan believes in division and hatred, and Jesus Christ believed in love and to love your neighbour. So I don't see how they really are saying they want to bring Christ back into Christmas.
Yes, I mean, I'm no expert, but it seems to me that Jesus was all about compassion and love, about welcoming strangers and caring for those in need, which don't seem to be the attributes that you would associate with the far right.
No, I mean,
appear to be adopting Jesus as their own, or trying to.
Well, they're trying to hijack Jesus, which is a strange thing. You know, if anybody's read the Gospels, you hear that, you know, Jesus meets a woman who they say is a fallen woman, and then people want to stone her, and he says, cast the first stone if you're sinless. And I think, you know, what you see amongst these people is the hypocrisy of there's not one moment of compassion in these people. So, you know, it doesn't really make any sense. And also, it wasn't a gospel that was only preached to people from Britain or from England. So I think they're misunderstanding what really the question of compassion and love is all supposed to be about. And actually they're replacing it with hate and division. And I don't believe that was a message that's been supposed to be preached at Christmas. It's goodwill to all people, not hatred to people. So I think we should reject the message of the far right and embrace the message of goodwill to all people.
Do you think that this message from the far right is a relatively new phenomenon, or are they sort of gaining ground both in this country and abroad?
Well, the tragedy is, I think that they're growing. They're growing out of the despair that exists today around both economic and personal issues, that people are looking for a scapegoat sometime. I mean, all of us were taught very carefully that the 1930s crash in America was due to overspending on the stock exchange. In Germany, people believed the 1930s crash was caused by Jewish people, which is completely a lie. But millions of people believed it, and it led, unfortunately, to the Holocaust, and it leads to division and hatred, or, you know, the destruction of people that were gay, the destruction of people that were travellers or were gypsies. It led to the most horrible situation. So we shouldn't... all of these things were supposed to have been done in the name of, you know, purity and the pure church. And I think that we should remember what Pastor Nemela said. First, they came for the Jews. I wasn't a Jew. I didn't speak up. They came for the communists. I wasn't a communist. I didn't speak up. And when they came for me, there was no one left. And so we have to speak up now and make sure those divisions don't become normalized.
Do you think it's a genuine misunderstanding of the teachings of Jesus, or are they perhaps trying to use religion as a weapon?
I think they are trying to use religion as a weapon. I think these people, basically, and I hate to say this, I mean, most of the people that are religious start off with compassion and loving each other, and they don't start with division and hatred. But I think what they want to do is to legitimize the most heinous acts by saying that God wills it. And I think that what we have to do is to make sure that you don't end up in a society that's basically completely intolerant and completely driven by division and hatred and despair. And, you know, usually people at Christmas want to bring all families together, regardless of their religion, regardless of where the families are from. People want a period of unity and escape from sometimes the terrible things that happen in our society. I think they won't even allow us those 1 or 2 days to be free from hatred, and so that we can celebrate that we're all together, regardless of colour or creed.
You know, you said that this kind of thing is on the rise. Is it possible that it might actually supplant the belief that people have had from the church? It might their message might actually be heard more loudly by a new generation of younger people who haven't been to church and heard the word directly.
You know, to be honest, in America, there's a group of people who call themselves Christian nationalists. And they have, in some senses, gathered around colleges, younger places, and convinced people of some of the worst things, do you mean? And I think that, you know, it's possible that when people have got enough money, the millionaires are backing them, people like Elon Musk, right, that the message of hate can trump the message of love and unity. And we've got to do our best to make sure that solidarity, unity and love conquer hatred and division. And that's what usually is preached by different religions. It's usually peace and unity, not hatred and division.
Well, you've alluded to social media there, and do you think that actually the people who are intent on sowing division actually have a much bigger megaphone now with their ownership of social media, whether they own it or just post on it, rather than a vicar in the pulpit preaching to a dwindling number of adherents?
You know, there's a lot of people that say they're priests, who are on, are on Twitter and all these things that get into our children's homes much easier than a priest would. And I think that we have to turn around and, actually, to be honest, let's be honest, all the churches I've spoken to, all the different faith groups have come together to reject the message of hatred. And I think we have to embrace that and make sure that these are the voices that are heard and not the fake vicars and not the people who, as I said, are closer to Satan than they are to Jesus, are the people that are heard.
We've talked about using religion as a weapon. Is it also being used as a shield to deflect criticism of anything that they might want to do to people who aren't like them?
That pretending that there's an exclusivity and you're not in the circle, so you have people that are of Muslim faith, or even though they both, you know, claim from the same Semitic kind of reasoning from their Bibles, their different Bibles, that they all use together and share the same religious groups of people, the Abrahamic link. But they are trying to exclude different peoples in order to build up a level of hatred so that they can have the pogroms that took place that horrified us in the 30s, but maybe directed against Muslims or Hindus or different groups of people. And we have to make sure that these people who say God is on their side and endorse attacks on physical or emotional attacks on people are something which we expose and push back and say that's not to do with religion, that's the politics of hate, that's the politics of the far right, and we reject it.
And yet their voice is very loud. Do you think that the church has been kind of left behind in this, in the technological race? They're still trying to get the message out as they did 100 years ago, but time's moved on.
When I've spoken to the church, I've explained to them that these people are liars, right? And the church has approached it in a way everybody, they'll listen to everybody and they'll persuade them. So it's taken a bit of time for them to realise so the people who are on the far right are actually telling lies, open lies. I mean, it's in their book, isn't it? They say that Satan is the father of lies. They should know, right? And therefore, it's taken, the church has woken up. It's a a slow sleeping beast, but I'm pretty sure that if every congregation from whichever denomination repeats what's inside the Bible, they should love each other, love thy neighbour as the main thing of being able to organise, we can push these people back and say, you're not adhering to something you claim to be.
But are you concerned that the number of people who actually go to church seems to be dwindling? I mean, I'm looking at the number of churches that have been sold off. It's the last 10 years is something like 3,500, and they weren't sold because they're popular. They were sold because nobody goes anymore. And yet the explosion in social media seems to be never-ending. And is the actual message of God going to be sort of completely lost, sort of drowned out by those who shout the loudest?
Well, to be honest, you're right in a certain way that before the organized religion of people going on a Sunday, that's gone and a kind of electronic church has been built. We have just to make sure that the people that are doing the preaching are properly vetted and are exposed when they're actually bringing false witness. And that's going to take time, and we're going to have to unite together. And do you know what I mean? I'm quoting Malcolm X, but he said, we're the majority. The majority of people are Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, or no faith, yeah, who believe in working together for humanity. But we have to rebuild the structures to allow us to make sure that our voices are heard so that we get reflected as wanting to live in a peaceful society.
You know, some say that despite the reduction in the number of people that go to church, that there's stories that I've heard several times of people saying, well, actually, young people, teenagers, and those in their early 20s, are sort of finding an interest in the church, and they're doing so through their use of social media. They're looking for a meaning to their life, and I guess that's as good a place to find one, or better perhaps, than whatever may come up on their social media feeds.
I think there's a crisis for a generation of young people. Their lives are worse than their parents' lives. And then they're seeking a spiritual answer as well. Because one of the things that have been damaged is civic society, spiritual support and solidarity between each other. And so people are seeking that. So we have to make sure that when they're given, you know, placebos, like false unity, like Unite the Kingdom, that that's replaced by genuine togetherness. So I think we're going to have to rebuild some of the institutions, not necessarily the churches, but the networks that exist between different people, so they have a sense of both social and spiritual solidarity between each other, so that these people who are trying to divide us have a less of a way in. And we have to talk about those things. That's why there's been an explosion of mental health or different issues. We have to begin to address the needs of our young people to try and push a more positive message about they have got a future, and that future is together.
Very good to talk to you, Wayman. Thanks so much for that. Wayman Bennett, co-convener of the charity Stand Up to Racism. So what do you make of that? The Church of England launching a poster campaign aimed at challenging the anti-migrant message of people like Tommy Robinson. His Unite the Kingdom movement has urged its supporters to join an event next week to, in his words, put the Christ back into Christmas. Now, the Church of England's decision to challenge the right-wing stance of Robinson comes amid growing unease among church leaders about the rise of Christian nationalism and the appropriation of Christian symbols to bolster the views of its supporters. What do you make of all that? 0345 6060 973. Let's talk to Rose in Devon. Hello, Rose.
Oh, hello, Nick. Yes, I've got a bit to say about this, and if I may quote two things. It seems to me that maybe part of the methodology of the extreme right, you know, is to pose as the opposite of what they are. Just as people hoping to impose US-style autocracy here, remember, pretended they were the democratic ones and told us we are in a totalitarian state. So the US far right especially, they spread white supremacist, homophobic and misogynistic propaganda. And in the case of leaders like Trump, they're amassing, I would say, disgusting quantities of personal wealth, often in gold, and meanwhile claim to follow the embodiment of divine love. born in a manger. Now, Nick, I'm not a person of faith, and yet many statements ring true to me and sit very uncomfortably with the US regime and the likes of Tommy Robinson. Jesus said, love one another as I have loved you. And also, consider the lilies of the field, how they grow, they toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. It seems to me, Nick, an absolute world away from any of those people. You know?
Yes, well, it does occur to me, I mean, I said it in the conversation I just had with Waylon, that people are using religion as a weapon. They use it as a weapon to beat up those who they object to, but they also use it as a shield to protect themselves from criticism.
Yes, yes, exactly. We are the good ones, but I mean, I find myself, and it's odd, isn't it? Because as I say, I cannot claim to have faith, but I find it obscene. It offends so deeply. That man is saying, put Christ back in Christmas. You know what I mean? I mean, I can't say anymore, really. It is so obvious to me that the whole shtick of the extreme right is to present themselves as the absolute opposite of what they are.
Well, claim victimhood.
Claim victimhood?
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose.
Mm. We're being suppressed, you know, that sort of thing. It's a trait of those that shout the loudest to say that we're being our ability to speak is being taken away from us.
Oh, and of course, it's yes, that's
pretty,
right.
Pretty much all you hear. Good talking to you, Rose. Thanks for that. More of your calls to come. This is LBC.
LBC.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny.
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. These changes will affect how you manage your tenancies. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
When you're smiling,
don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling. Keep on smiling. And the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So there is what is described as a Christian carol event to be thrown at a location unknown by the far right to, in their words, reclaim our heritage, culture and Christian identity. Well, who to believe? The Church of England, who oppose all of the above, or the flag wavers who are putting it on? You decide. 0345 6060 973. Chelsea, Andrew.
Hello, Nick. I absolutely love your show.
Oh, thanks.
I just wanted to offer a couple of counterpoints to the discussion you just had with the gentleman who was on. Or rather, like, expand it outwards. First of all, you know, it's true that some churches, or many churches, are shrinking or disappearing, but that's mostly Protestantism. So Catholicism is actually growing, especially in the West. And Orthodoxy, which is my flavour of Christianity, or I'm becoming an Orthodox Christian, basically. And Eastern Orthodoxy is growing very, very fast. So, for example, in my local cathedral, there were 800 people signed up in the last year to learn about Christianity. And that's just one cathedral. And so this is happening all over the world, especially in the West.
That sort of goes against everything that I've read about the situation that confronts the established religions. I mean, the 3,500 churches closed in the last 10 years in this country. So explain.
How many of them were Orthodox? How many of them were Catholic? How many of them were Protestant? So this country, you know, most of the churches are Protestant. So I can just tell you that this is my understanding. I know Orthodoxy better than Catholicism. And my understanding is that Catholicism is growing, especially in the West, and also Eastern Orthodoxy is growing very, very fast, and I can testify to that firsthand. But also, the other point I wanted to make is, you know, Jesus wasn't a politician. It's not just the right that try to co-opt Jesus for their politics. It's like, you know, if people kind of use Jesus to try and justify, e.g., for example, absolutely unlimited immigration, which could potentially have damaging effects on a culture that is built on Christianity, that's like a counter argument. But it's basically, my main point is, it's not just the right that co-opt Jesus, and God and love and Jesus are beyond politics. You know, it's about love, like you said. It's not about politics, so let's not co-opt it either from the right or the left.
Yes, but everything is about politics, really, isn't it? You know, the discussion of the topic that you brought up, immigration, it's all politics. I mean, you could say that it's about kindness and it's about acceptance and it's about spreading love, but it isn't really. It's about which political actor can say something that they think will increase their chances of pleasure in the short term.
Well, that's what it's about for political people and people who are into power. But speaking as a Christian, it absolutely is about love. And the only reason I mentioned immigration is because, just to give you a counterexample of how the left try and co-opt Jesus to their politics as well. But speaking as a Christian, we put God, Christ, love and the Holy Spirit first and beyond all politics. It's above and beyond all politics in its essence.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, but I also think it's a bit difficult to talk about and to address big issues like immigration and it not be political in its essence. No, I understand you can come to those topics with, you know, a feeling of compassion, but whatever comes out of your mouth or whatever opinions you hold, they will be sort of coloured by your political opinions,
I'm not talking about bringing religion into politics. I'm talking about taking politics out of religion. Right. So, for example, our priests don't bang on about politics in church. So it's all kinds of people are trying to drag Jesus and God into politics. And I'm trying to say,
I understand that God may be above and beyond it, but we aren't, because, you know, we are individuals with faults. And, you know, you can pretty much get, I would imagine, I haven't read it, but my understanding is, any political position, you could get a passage from the Bible that would back up that position. So whatever you say as far as your religious beliefs are concerned will be based on which particular passages you happen to pick out in isolation that back up your opinion. So I think it's impossible to take politics out of anything, really, except maybe sport. Thanks, Andrew. 0345 6060 973. And I'm not talking about the running of sport. I mean the actual, you know, the physical action of it. Art. Well, maybe not art. Ealing. Hello, Grace.
Hi. So I grew up in a Christian family, and I realised I didn't really understand why I should believe any of it. And then when I was studying science, I came to conclude that actually I did believe that God exists, and have been really frustrated to see how, indeed, Christianity is being co-opted. But this has been going on since Jesus' time, or at least religion has been co-opted since Jesus' time. Jesus spent a lot of time arguing with people who feigned religiosity and who Jesus knew weren't actually in their hearts seeking to follow God, but who were, as you've said many times, using religion as a cover, as a way to feel noble, as a way to assert dominance over others. And Jesus got really flipping angry, flipping literally. That's why he flipped tables. Mm. With these people who were doing this. So this has been going on all the time. I thought when you mentioned how Tommy Robinson wants us to reclaim our heritage of the occasion on which Jesus says to some people, do not say to yourselves, we are sons of Abraham, for God could make out of these stones sons of Abraham. So Jesus is basically saying, you shouldn't be taking pride in your heritage. And that's exactly what Tommy Robinson and the likes are trying to do. And the most important thing about Christianity isn't necessarily just social teachings, although Jesus' teachings about loving others and loving our neighbour. And when he teaches us to love our neighbour, he is specifically referring to people from other places. That's the point of the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's not just the people who live next door. People who we don't think are the same as us.
Yes.
But the most important thing is to choose personally to repentantly turn to Jesus and to recognize one's own sin. And if you're going around being really proud of yourself because you think, well, I am from this brilliant nation and I have this great heritage and the badness in the world, it comes from over there. It comes from those Muslim places or whatever it is. You are completely ignoring Jesus' key teaching, which is to recognize one's own sin and flaws and to turn humbly to Jesus. And the way that Tommy Robinson and, quote, Christian nationalist, although I really think Christian nationalist is an oxymoron, that the way they bang on is illustrative of not humbly turning to Christ, in addition to not having care for one's neighbours. It's the pride and the arrogance and the inability to accept that all of us have sinned and need Jesus. They're not doing that. They're taking pride in themselves, and actually God doesn't like pride.
Good to talk to you, Grace. Thanks for that. Coventry, Frieda.
Hello.
Frieda.
Hi. I'm not sure if this is appropriate, but two things in relation to, what's his name?
Tommy Robinson.
Thank you. His nutcase. Number one would be, what religion is he actually prescribed to? Invite him onto LBC and ask him to tell you which church he goes to on a Sunday so that you can go and film him.
Well, you don't have to go to a church to have religion. But
true.
What's the
but
second
normally,
thing?
If there's anything of substance in his sudden religious fever, I'm sure he must go to church occasionally. I just thought it was worth asking the question. It made me laugh. And then, what's the second thing?
Yeah.
Are there any links to the American, what's it called, Christian National
yes.
Church?
Well, they seem to say the same things. I would think that, yeah, part of the same movement. It would be my expectation. Thank you, Frieda. I've got to go because I've just run out of time in this. So thanks for your calls and your messages and so on. I'm going to take a break for the news. We're still going to check in with our US correspondent a little later in this hour. But have you heard? Liz Truss has a new position. She's fashioned herself a new job. We'll talk about how that is going after this news update with Tim Daly.
Millions of pounds are to be spent on protecting the UK's undersea links from Russian interference and sabotage. The Defence Secretary, John Healey, says the country and its allies are ready to begin tracking and deterring the Kremlin's submarines. More government measures aimed at getting young people into work are due to be announced by the Prime Minister later. Sir Keir Starmer's government is now looking to develop 50,000 apprenticeships at a cost of £725 million. And it's believed the leader of the Conservatives will use a news conference later to demand the government accelerates the creation of a national grooming gangs inquiry. Kemi Badenoch is also thought to be releasing a new draft terms of reference for the investigation. LBC weather, dry with clear spells for much of the country overnight. Heavy showers will return in the southwest later, though. They could include hail and thunder. We'll see a low of 5 degrees.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
They come here because they know it's a soft touch.
Straight to the point.
How does this even add up?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
This is a Whitehall farce, without any doubt.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Everything has led to this moment. The Porsche Cayenne Black Edition. 2 decades of evolution have created the refined SUV with true Porsche performance. With enhanced personalization, athletic detailing, and high gloss black finish, the Black Edition isn't just driven, it's felt. This is the moment where style meets precision. The brand new Porsche Cayenne Black Edition. 20 years in the making. To book your test drive, search Porsche Guildford or visit Porsche.co.uk. Porsche, there is no substitute.
Get the news your way and combine breaking news with expert opinion to see the full picture.
With award-winning journalism on air and in your hand, the LBC app puts you in control.
The biggest stories of the day delivered how you want it
and when you want it.
Download the LBC app now.
News your way.
Now in your hands.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
The Guardian said the Liz Truss show was hapless ravings from a cupboard and gave it a one-star review out of five. The Times' Tom Peck said it's the kind of thing you would expect if you asked an AI model to make a video of a primary school teacher reading out a Donald Trump speech in the style of an airline safety announcement. Let's talk to Aubrey Allegretti, the chief political correspondent for The Times, who is joining us on the phone now. Good evening, Aubrey.
Good evening.
Well, Liz Truss, she's tried many hats, literally in the case of the one that she paraded around in Moscow and the red MAGA one that she wore in Washington. She's tried her hand at punditry on right-wing opinion TV stations. What's she doing now?
I think primarily she's seeking to rebuild her reputation. This is a woman who feels that she was completely unjustly ousted from office after just 49 days as prime minister and has really become a figure of national ridicule. You know, people used to compare her to a lettuce. I think on the international stage, she's very aware that she has a very sort of poor reputation. And so partly this is about trying to say her piece, but it's also about trying to find relevance again, particularly with that US audience that you just talked about there. She's been really sort of trying to dig in, present herself as a friend and confidant of the MAGA crowd in Washington.
Yeah, she seems to be positioning herself as a sort of critic abroad, to put it one way. I mean, others might say she's a sort of lady whore, talking down this country while in another.
She certainly was incredibly declinist about Britain. And actually, she talked up the Trump revolution that she said was happening in the US. She talked about the themes in the UK of the economy, immigration, public services and national identity. She had guests on who were very sort of heavily slanted towards the Reform UK party, which I think is actually tried to keep quite a lot of distance from her because they're wary about being sort of tainted by her quite toxic brand. And so she was basically speaking to somebody, Matthew Goodwin, who's a commentator, potential Reform UK candidate at the next general election, and Alex Phillips, who is a Brexit Party MEP. They were really trying to cement this idea that you often hear from Nigel Farage, that Britain is broken.
Yeah, the program itself was a podcast, and it's TV without the budget, which doesn't matter if you have a flair for it. Does Liz Truss have a flair for it?
Well, she tried this sort of new opening monologue style, which we've seen from late night talk shows. Andrew Neil used to sort of perfect it on This Week, but it has to often be delivered with gravitas, and this felt a little bit shaky. The tech was sort of a bit all over the place. In terms of some of the speakers, you couldn't see them when they were talking. It was just sort of transfixed on Liz Truss's face as she was responding. And it didn't sound like anything from her that you wouldn't expect her to say. She was attacking British institutions like the BBC. She used the sort of usual culture bashing arguments, talking about trans activists and how Humphrey Appleby would be a trans activist today. So it felt like a real sort of embrace, just the greatest highlights, really, of the radical right and what we hear from the US.
Yeah, she seems very self-assured in her opinions, particularly her opinions of herself. Is that justified, or is she actually deluded?
Well, you do speak to people that think that actually if she's gone through such a sort of period of national humiliation and shame, that it must have caused quite a lot of psychological difficulty for her, because she would have had to sort of try and shoulder that and figure out what went wrong. And there are two ways to respond to that. Either you accept responsibility, take the blame and shoulder what's happened and try and kind of come back to public life from it, or you basically just kind of put your tinfoil hat on and pretend that you were completely set against from the start, that there were unspecified sort of shadowy forces working against you, otherwise known, I think, as the Conservative Party. And so it all just feeds into this very conspiratorial narrative. So I don't really felt like we learned much from this TV show, but there is going to be another episode next Friday. So let's see if there's more to come.
Yeah, her contention is that she was brought down by the deep state. Now, does she have any scintilla of a point there?
Well, I suppose it depends on what your definition of the deep state is. She never faced a leadership challenge per se, but I think it was quite clear that the bond markets were very rattled by her significant tax cuts, which were not offset by public spending reductions. Obviously, those infamous comments from Kwasi Kwarteng when he said that there's more to come were what really rattled them. And it's undeniable that there was a huge spike of inflation that happened almost directly after the mini-budget, which was delivered in September 2022. She was brought down because she didn't have the confidence of the parliamentary party. And in one respect, this is a fault of the Conservative Party leadership election rules, which mean that effectively MPs do not get to choose who their leader is in Parliament. It's down to members. And before it had gone to membership, Liz Truss was definitely not the clear favourite. Rishi Sunak was. So it's not actually that surprising that when she came to be their party leader, the MPs turned around to her and said, fine, we've given you a little bit of a chance here, but you've delivered a mini-budget. We don't like you. We didn't like you in the first place. So I don't think it's quite as deep a state as she makes it out to be.
Do you have any sympathy for her? I mean, as we've alluded to, she was the briefest serving Prime Minister in our history, relentlessly trolled for not outlasting a lettuce, constantly shown up for her awkwardness. I mean, what's a woman to do when her world comes crashing down except pick yourself up, dust yourself down and try all over again?
Certainly. Well, I mean, in some ways, Liz Truss was a bit of a positive pioneer. She actually delivered a party conference speech, which I was at in October 2022, where she was talking about growth and how it was basically the biggest challenge facing the country in terms of rebooting our economy after almost a decade of stagflation. And she was talking about the anti-growth coalition. Again, it sounded a little bit conspiratorial at the time. But what she was effectively doing was criticising blockers, NIMBYs, people who were putting up obstacles, sometimes unfairly, to major infrastructure projects, to building houses. And so there was quite a lot of good intent behind some of her ideas. But the way it was executed, the sort of panache, I think you hear from people around her, the arrogance which they think that she exuded at that time, completely put everybody on edge. And that was one of the things that meant that she wasn't able to corral her party and lead them with her, even though she was facing those really tough times.
Yes. I mean, having said that, though, Liz Truss gets and will get £115,000 every year for life for being our briefest serving Prime Minister. A blink of an eye and she was gone. I mean, that's taxpayers' money. And she's spending her time knocking the country that pays it to her and actively encouraging Donald Trump to attack the BBC, one of the defining institutions of Britain. Should she be taking that money while trying to, or actually damaging the country that gives it to her?
It's one of the sort of vices and virtues of having an unwritten constitution, which means that we effectively are at the behest of political parties in terms of how they choose their leaders and prime ministers. And there is obviously some discussion about Keir Starmer and how secure he is. Actually, the way to sort of get rid of a Labour prime minister is much harder than for a Conservative one. But it is, at the end of the day, up to those political parties. That's the sort of political system that we buy into as voters who sort of participate in and agree with the system that we use. However, obviously, Liz Truss is going to be this sort of permanent fixture as a former PM. It means that she, for example, attends Remembrance Day events and at a big state occasions, she will continue to get an invite. So she will still be rubbing shoulders with her predecessor, Boris Johnson, and her successor, Rishi Sunak. But I think a large part of what this podcast is about is a huge tilt to the US and basically just trying to cozy up to the MAGA Trump White House crowds to be able to find that relevance and belonging where she's lost it in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, she seems to have deliberately cut the cord with Britain. I mean, I guess it was half severed, and then she delivered the final cut. And she's made herself pretty much friendless in this country. What will happen if her bet on American MAGA alignment doesn't work? I mean, do Americans even know who she is?
Well, she's been to CPAC, which is the sort of headline national conservatism conference in the US, and she is, you know, sort of hosted on things by like Fox News. There was that infamous video of where she sort of held her
book Upside Down, you remember, the yes. 10 years to save the West. So it all seems sometimes to us a little bit kind of zany, but why would she be taken seriously there when she isn't taken very seriously here? But I think ultimately she just sees an opportunity to be relevant with a crowd on the other side of the pond. She thinks that the MAGA movement is continuing to grow, that even when Trump steps down at the next election, that he's going to be succeeded by a senior sort of figure who will carry on the flame like J.D. Vance. And so she thinks that she's probably going to play the long game and end up potentially in a more financially better position because she's gotten close to those figures.
And having seen the first episode, are you going to make a weekly appointment to view?
I think we're going to have to. I mean, it's almost too good not to watch. You know, it's how much of it is sort of for comic value and how much of it is for news and journalistic value, we'll have to see. But she obviously has some serious points to raise. But in terms of how she makes them, she needs to probably start inviting on to more kind of mainstream commentators to be able to start gaining that kind of traction if she wants to be taken more seriously by voters again, because all the polling suggests that they are not forgiving of what she did.
That is certainly true. Aubrey, thanks so much for your time. Aubrey Allegretti, Chief Political Correspondent for The Times. Now we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will be off to America to talk to Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent. This is LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Clive Ball.
Is it time Labour changed its stance on Brexit and the customs union? And how realistic are the government's plans to allow fully driverless vehicles on UK roads?
Clive Ball at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app.
Everything has led to this moment. The Porsche Cayenne Black Edition. Two decades of evolution have created the refined SUV with true Porsche performance. With enhanced personalization, athletic detailing, and high gloss black finish, the Black Edition isn't just driven, it's felt. This is the moment where style meets precision. The brand new Porsche Cayenne Black Edition. 20 years in the making. To book your test drive, search Porsche Guildford or visit Porsche.co.uk. Porsche, there is no substitute.
Come on, guys, we're late!
Mum, can I borrow your phone quickly?
Are we there yet?
Can someone check we're going the right way on maps, please?
Are we there yet?
Oh, my phone's out of battery.
Here you go, use mine.
Can someone call Nan to let her know we're on our way?
Oh, are we there yet?
Guesting this Christmas? You need the UK's best mobile network. EE does more.
UK's best network. Root metrics data H125. Verify at ee.critic.ca/claims.
The halls are decked with guaranteed wins every Friday in December on the Sky Vegas prize machine. It's free to play. Simply opt in and spin to win. Each prize comes with its own terms and expiry dates. Play Prize Machine and join over 1 million winners this year. There's so much to unwrap this festive season at Sky Vegas. Mini game must be played for bonus rounds feature. Eligibility restrictions and T's and C's apply. 18+ gamblerware.org.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Simon Marks is on the line from Washington, D.C. Hello, Simon.
Evening, Nick.
Now, this is something that I am unfamiliar with, but apparently it comes out with, to not much comment in each administration. It's a thing called the National Security Strategy, and just basically puts on paper what we already know about the priorities of the administration. Now, the Trump administration has just released their National Security Strategy, and it did not go without comment at all, did it?
Indeed. I mean, I cannot underscore how important this is. This is a 29-page document that the State Department released on Friday. It has a 2-page introduction by President Donald Trump. Absolutely, it's got the president's imprimatur. And it means that effectively, when European leaders now gather in London in a few hours' time, they are going to be waking up to the fact that for the first time in 80 years, the United States no longer has their backs. This document is a total clarion explanation of Donald Trump's priorities in foreign policy, his flaying of Europe, his determination to try and grease the wheels for what he referred to in this document as patriotic European parties. In other words, Nigel Farage and Reform UK in Britain, Marine Le Pen and her movement in France, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands. This is a document that wants to see, as official government policy, far-right political parties taking power in Europe. It says that Europe has atrophied because its member states have allowed unrestrained immigration to take place that is going to create what it describes as civilizational erasure of the European Union and everything that it stands for. It says that within a matter of years, what it refers to as non-European populations will be in the majority in so many member states of NATO in Europe that those populations won't have any interest in NATO's collective defence. So it basically flushes the idea of the transatlantic alliance, the NATO alliance, essentially saying it doesn't really matter what we do, because in a few years' time it's going to be deemed irrelevant by the majority non-European populations of many European countries. And what is so extraordinary about this document is that it only uses the word democracy three times. And the first time it uses it is on page 16. Now, if you go back to all previous American presidents and their national security strategies, certainly since Ronald Reagan, they've all been couched in those Reagan terms of the United States being a shining beacon, the city on the hill, the beacon of democracy, protecting and advancing freedom around the world, speaking out against dictators and the gulags that they run. This document has none of that underpinning its national security strategy. Indeed, it actually goes so far as to say, and this is a quote, "We seek good relations and peaceful commercial relations with the nations of the world without imposing on them democratic or other social change that differs widely from their traditions and histories." And that is one of many reasons why I suspect this weekend there's been an open bar at the Kremlin. Vladimir Putin's press secretary Dmitry Peskov, in a statement over the weekend, said that this new American national security strategy is largely consistent with Moscow's vision of the future, which really, again, underscores what a stunning departure this is from orthodox American foreign policy.
Yeah, it's like Stephen Miller's brain threw up on 30 pieces of paper. One of the things it talks about is Europe. I mean, you've referenced this, Europe facing a civilizational erasure. I mean, that's white replacement theory, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely. It is white replacement theory. It is this theory that's being advanced here now of re-immigration. I mean, actually, you know, kicking everybody out, denaturalizing even American citizens here that have been born in other countries and have secured American citizenship. We saw just astonishing reports coming out of Boston this weekend. There was a citizenship ceremony taking place in Faneuil Hall in Boston, one of the hallmarks of America's struggle for independence, a really iconic location in Boston that visitors always go to visit. As the people were gathering to take their oaths of allegiance to the United States, you know, their citizenship oaths, various officials started calling out the names of various countries and said that any foreign nationals from those countries needed to stand up and leave the hall. And those people discovered that they suddenly were not going to be naturalized as American citizens. This is the kind of behavior that this national security strategy wants to see in Europe. And, you know, in a way, I mean, as unprecedented and in many ways horrifying as this document is, in a way, it's also extremely clarifying. I mean, there can be no one in number 10 or the Foreign Office today who can read this document and think that it is possible to continue down the path of pretending that any kind of normal diplomatic relationship is going to be possible with this American government. And that, I think, is one of the reasons why the French President Emmanuel Macron and others are now hastily heading to London. They were already deeply alarmed over everything that they'd heard from the White House over the last few days regarding the Ukraine negotiation. And this document, again, underscores the fact that Donald Trump is more than ready to capitulate to Russia on Ukraine. He basically puts Ukraine in this document on notice that the Trump administration finds itself at odds with European officials who hold unrealistic expectations for the war. This is a total restatement of American foreign policy. And as I say, it's only 29 pages long, which is ludicrously short. I actually got to the end of it and thought that my computer had not loaded the rest of it, so I refreshed the page, and it just ends basically in the middle of various claims about Africa, insisting that the United States essentially wants to march into Africa and take away all of its rare earth and other valuable minerals. I thought there must be more to this than just these 29 pages. There isn't, but as I say, it is only 29 pages, and everyone should get onto the White House website and read it, because it's an absolutely astonishing read, including one section where they're talking about Ukraine, which, a bit like that 28-point peace plan, read to me almost as though it had been put through some kind of a Google translation bit of software from Russian to English.
Yeah.
There's one section that is just very clunky. It sounds very Russian.
Yeah. And, of course, a part of this document is that the U.S. seeks to re-establish strategic stability with Russia. That's their phrase. And as you said, Russia, Putin, he said that all of this is largely consistent with Moscow's vision. And on the other hand, it seems to call for the toppling of all of the centre-left and centre-right governments of Europe.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. It says that it finds optimism in the rise of what it refers to as patriotic parties. Now, obviously, when it talks about patriotic parties, it doesn't mean Keir Starmer's government. It means Nigel Farage and Reform UK. And, yeah. You know, you and I have been talking about this for weeks. We talked about this around the time of the state visit, when it was absolutely apparent that the second that visit was over and Donald Trump left town with the picture of him and the Queen in his breast pocket, that he was immediately going to begin the process of undermining the Prime Minister and trying to help Nigel Farage win the keys to number 10 in the next presidential election. And this document says it in black and white. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suspect the Foreign Secretary will say, well, Labour, of course, is a patriotic party. And, you know, but that is clearly not the kind of no. political party that Donald Trump means to endorse here.
No, I mean, the way they put it was, US policy is to prioritise resistance to Europe's current trajectory.
Totally, exactly. And where do you find that resistance? You find it among the far-right parties, not just in the UK, but in other countries all over the European Union.
Yeah, and it's a litany of anti-woke, fake Christianity panic about the erasure of Western culture, and also, much expectedly, to increase America's influence over South America, to take control of the Panama Canal, bring down the government of Venezuela, the country,
yes,
coincidentally, with by far the largest oil reserves in the world, and essentially update the 200-odd-year-old Monroe Doctrine to essentially declare Latin America off limits to anybody else.
Yes, absolutely. This is a restatement of the Monroe Doctrine of 1823, which basically provided precedent for America's territorial expansion. I mean, you read this document and you come to the conclusion that Greenland is although it's not mentioned, is definitely going to be on the table. He's definitely in the business of territorial expansion. But what the Monroe Doctrine also did was to declare the Western Hemisphere to be America's zone of influence. They described this document as the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. But the idea that the Monroe Doctrine is being revived by this president, who of course has spoken about Canada becoming America's 51st state, taking over Greenland, building Trump Gaza, wants to go in and essentially oust President Nicolas Maduro from power in Venezuela in order to take control of the country's massive oil reserves, or at least force Nicolas Maduro to agree to some kind of economic cooperation pact that will see the United States getting its hands on Venezuelan oil. These are the drivers now behind President Trump's foreign policy, and this is no longer debatable because it's there in black and white.
Yes, and particularly they have enmity for the concept of a European Union, don't
yes.
they? They want to split the various nations into their back to their individual countries, because I would imagine the European Union presents a strong force against America. I mean, the US, it seems to me, they can't stand that social democracies actually work, that you can have universal health care, you can have state support when you are at your most needy, that a winner-takes-all economy doesn't make a happier country.
Yeah, and it is not coincidental, Nick, that this weekend, in the immediate aftermath of the publication of this document, Elon Musk, you know, former player in Donald Trump's inner circle, has been on a tear this weekend on X, insisting that the European Union should be abolished. He, of course, doesn't like the regulation that it's bringing to his businesses. Christopher Landau, the Deputy Secretary of State, this is the man who goes to America's airports to welcome white Afrikaners as refugees when they arrive in the United States, while this country is closing its doors to all other refugees. He's been in Brussels for a NATO ministerial meeting, and he took to X this weekend to say the US has long failed to address the glaring inconsistency between its relations with NATO and the EU. He says these are almost all the same countries in both organizations. When these countries wear their NATO hats, they insist that transatlantic cooperation is the cornerstone of mutual security. But when they wear their EU hats, they pursue all sorts of agendas that are utterly adverse to US interests and security. He says this inconsistency cannot continue. We cannot pretend we are partners while these nations allow the EU's unelected, undemocratic and unrepresentative bureaucracy to pursue policies of civilizational suicide.
Yeah. Just when you thought it couldn't get worse, it
indeed
just did. Simon, always a pleasure. Thank you so
cheers,
much for
Nick.
That. Simon Marks, LBC's Washington correspondent there. Now, if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, on which you can read and watch the latest from LBC. You can put your news categories in the order you want. You can pause and rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts. If you don't have it, it's free. Get the LBC app from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Good morning. Still to come, the Health Secretary Wes Streeting has described GPs who oppose his rollout of a new online booking system as moaning minis. But are you one of those who struggle to get an appointment or a hospital referral from your local doctor? But first, Germany's parliament's voted to introduce voluntary military service in a move aimed at boosting national defences after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It marks a big shift in Germany's approach to its military, and it follows Chancellor Friedrich Merz's push to create Europe's strongest conventional army. Well, the change means that all 18-year-olds in Germany will be sent a questionnaire from January next year asking if they're interested in joining the armed forces. So this morning, do you think that some form of national service would be a force for good in the UK?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom. The Defence Secretary says the UK and its allies are ready to begin tracking and deterring Russian submarines looking to sabotage the country's links beneath the sea. John Healey says a hybrid naval force named Atlantic Bastion will be used to protect cables and pipelines which deliver electricity, oil and gas. The security expert Professor Anthony Gleese has been telling LBC Russia cannot be dismissed.
If Putin has a win now in Ukraine, and America says it's no longer interested in European security as it once was. That means we in Europe need to step up whatever we need to do to make sure we're not next on Putin's list.
21 people, including a three-year-old girl, have been treated after a group of men allegedly used what police think was pepper spray during a robbery at Heathrow Airport. A 31-year-old man's been arrested. The policing and crime commentator Danny Shaw has been telling LBC pepper spray is illegal for a reason.
Normally, the sort of symptoms disappear within 30 minutes to an hour or so. Sometimes it can